Crop FM, Ausgabe Nummer 550. Wir schreiben den 13. Juni 2025. Mein Gast heute Abend ist Robert Guffey. Und es geht um Masons from Outer Space. Und auch heute gibt es natürlich die Zoom-Leitung und den Cropcom, mit dem man sich live an dieser Sendung beteiligen kann. Entweder nur im schreibenden Modus oder auch einfach anrufen und all die Fragen stellen, die ich nicht stelle. Und natürlich schaue ich vor allem im zweiten Teil dann auch vermehrt in den Cropcom. Von wo auch immer man diese Sendung hört, ein Besuch auf der Crop FM Website lohnt sich auf jeden Fall. Dort kann man sich an den Newsletter anmelden. Das ist dieses Symbol mit der Klingel. Kriegt man dann alle zwei Wochen, praktisch nie sonst und definitiv kein Spam, eine Erinnerung an die nächste Sendung. Vergisst man sie nicht so leicht. Und natürlich gibt es dort den RSS-Feed, einen Link, um mir zu mailen und das fast vollständige Audioarchiv. Und man kann auch einzelne Sendungen direkt verlinken und darüber freue ich mich natürlich auch sehr gern. Und ja, wem diese Sendung gefällt, weiter sagengemäß hören, desto mehr Spaß macht das. Und natürlich gibt es auch den Orangen-Button mit dem Herz, den Crop FM Spenden-Button. Geld wird nur zweckgebunden verwendet für, keine Ahnung, Server. Gehört wieder, ja, auch, naja, vor einiger Zeit einen neuen Server aufgestellt etc. Findet sich auf der Startseite, geht über PayPal als Überweisung. Oder auch als Bitcoin und an dieser Stelle ganz großes Danke an alle, die ihn schon verwendet haben. Und auch das heutige Coverbild ist wieder von Matthias Töpfer. Es ist großartig gelungen. Matthias arbeitet seit mehr als 40 Jahren freiberuflich als Grafiker, Illustrator, Fotodesigner etc. Er produziert und gestaltet Videospots, computeranimierte Dokumentationen und Buchtrailer, auch Buchcover natürlich. Und er ist auch bereit, seinen reichen Erfahrungsschatz als Consultant sozusagen weiterzugeben. Mehr auf seiner Website atelier-töpfer mit oe geschrieben.de, atelier-töpfer.de. Link ist auch unterm Ankündertext. Matthias Töpfer, der Illustrator von Crop FM. Ja, und die News der letzten Woche, über das Massaker in der Dreier-Schützengasse in Graz, da wurde schon viel gesagt und geschrieben. Sicher noch nicht alles, aber mir fällt dazu auch nicht mehr ein. Solche Dinge passieren meistens ja irgendwo weit, weit weg, aber eigentlich jede Woche sterben Frauen, unschuldige Kinder und so weiter. Aber wenn das dann vor der eigenen Haustür passiert, dann ist das anders. Eigentlich ist es das Gleiche, aber es ist trotzdem anders. Und wer sich da jetzt und natürlich, heute startet dann auch noch, Freitag der 13. Dieser Angriff auf den Iran, wer weiß, auch da werden wieder unzählige Unschuldige sterben und so weiter. Ja, und wer sich von dem Ganzen ein wenig ablenken möchte, der kann das auf Ultra Terrestrials tun und dort über die sehr Spannendes über die Stimme Gottes in Pan Turk, glaube ich, spricht man das aus, die da im Februar 2016 zu hören gewesen sein soll, lesen. Oder auch über den Villas-Boas-Fall aus den späten 50ern, Wiederkehr des Beb Kororoti oder eine Psy-Op, das fragt sich Vladislav Raab auf seinem Blog Alter Terrestrials. Und über den Villas-Boas-Fall, da werden wir heute sicher auch sprechen mit Robert Guffey. Und das Interview wird in Englisch sein, natürlich. Now stay tuned for my upcoming guest, Robert Guffey. We'll talk about his latest book, one of his latest books, Cryptopolis, and about Freemasons from Outer Space. Robert Guffey is a lecturer in the Department of English at California State University, Long Beach. His most recent books are Cryptopolis and Other Stories, The Expectant Mother Disinformation Handbook and Operation Mindfuck, and many, many more. Like Camellio, we did a show on that. It is a fantastic book. He's an outstanding connoisseur of the world of the highest strangeness, and he's also very aware of actual conspiracies playing out every day, aliens and owls and Masons. Hi, Robert.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me on. I think this is the third time.
It's the third time already, and I'm very glad to have you as my guest again.
This is my third degree.
Yes, if you wish. It's your third degree, and I hope we'll go to the 33rd then. All the way.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we should do one interview where you continue speaking in German and I will speak in English, and it'll just, if the conversation matches up, it'll be just pure synchronicity.
We can try that. It might fail, but we can give it a trial.
I once interviewed the painter Paul Laffoley, and Paul Laffoley used to attend regularly lectures by Buckminster Fuller, the famous, legendary American architect, Buckminster Fuller. And Laffoley told me that Buckminster Fuller would do these university lectures where I guess he had a hearing problem. And at the end, he would do like an hour of Q&As with the students. And he would turn his hearing aid all the way off, so he could not hear the questions. So he would just start talking, and if the answer somehow matched up with the question, it was just pure coincidence.
You know, I know a guy. I think he does that too.
It could be an interesting thought experiment.
Yeah, it could. Yeah, and I guess for some people it could match up quite well. Who knows? So Friday the 13th, it's a very appropriate date for our conversation.
Yes.
The Templar's Purge, as I call it, was on this day, right?
That's right. That's why Friday the 13th is considered bad luck, because that's the day that Jacques de Molay was burned at the stake.
And not only he, a lot of others as well.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, in Freemasonry, you have the de Molay Society, which is the Jacques de Molay Society, and that's for people who are under 18. If they want to join the Masons, they have a special de Molay Society that they can join. And various, Bill Clinton was a de Molay, and so was Walt Disney was in the Des Moines Society.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Disney was also an interesting guy. But for some, it's considered a lucky day. Who knows? Maybe for Catholics, it's considered a lucky day, right?
That's true. Yes. Yeah, maybe. Maybe they do think of it as a lucky day. Whenever my wife gets a new tattoo, she always does it on Friday the 13th. So she considers it to be a lucky day.
Yeah. There will be a lot of pop references this evening. Maybe I'll just add one with one. I mean, I always thought it interesting that in episode 3 there is this purge of the Jedi. It always remembered me on this Friday the 13th thing. I don't know.
You know, there's also there's a writer named Robert W. Sullivan, who is a 32nd degree Scottish Rite Freemason, and he has written a series of books about esoteric symbolism in Hollywood, and they're actually quite interesting. What's weird is his name is Robert W. Sullivan, and my name is Robert W. Guffey, and I've also written about esoteric cinema, and he is a 32nd degree Scottish Rite Freemason, and so am I. And we both became Masons around the same time, though I've never met him, though sometimes I wonder if maybe we're the same person. Has anyone ever seen us in the same room together? I don't know. But he actually has a very interesting books that he's written analyzing hermetic symbolism in film, and he has interesting analyses of the Friday the 13th movies. He ties them into, well, Jacques de Molay, obviously, but also, of course, the main character of Friday the 13th is Jason, that immediately brings up the Jason Society. Anyone who's ever read Behold the Pale Horse by William Cooper will be familiar with the Jason Society, and he sees interesting parallels in the first movie with tarot symbolism and moon symbolism with Diana. Of course, Jason is the only name that is an acronym for consecutive months of the year, July, August, September, October, November, which then brings us into the fall and winter. And so he sees all sorts of symbolism in that.
Okay. Oh my God.
I recommend looking into it. He wrote a book about the Royal Arch degree of Freemasonry. And in the last chapter, that's where he starts writing about the esoteric symbolism in cinema. And then from there, he started devoting whole books to just that subject. And I think he's up to like 4 or 5 volumes at this point. But Robert W. Sullivan, perhaps look that up. I recommend those books.
Okay.
And we are not the same person, as far as I know.
I don't know. I mean, you would know best, I guess. But then again,
maybe I wouldn't. I don't know.
Maybe you wouldn't. Yeah. Maybe you would be the only one who wouldn't know.
That's right.
Cryptopolis. Let's maybe start with one of your latest books. I mean, the later one is The Expectant Mother Disinformation Handbook. I have both books linked up. I've read Cryptopolis. I was utterly disturbed by it, but I couldn't stop reading neither. So it was a really interesting experience. I guess I never read a bunch of such weird stories in a row. And I think some of them are excerpts of, I call them Masonic dreams that you had, right?
Well, oddly enough, several of the, because it's a collection of Cryptopolis and other stories, was published by Lethe Press, which is operated by Steve Berman, who's a fine writer in his own right. He wrote an excellent collection of stories called Fit for Consumption, which I recommend. The collection includes 25 short stories published over the course of about 23 years, from 2000, which is when I published my first short story, The Infant Kiss, which is in the collection, all the way up to 2022, I think the latest story in the book is called On the Bus. And those aren't the only stories I've published, but those are the ones I decided to include in this particular sequence of stories. And many of the stories in the book have Gnostic, Hermetic, alchemical, Masonic, Kabbalistic themes. And many of them emerged from dreams. I wrote the title story, Cryptopolis, in between undergoing the second and third degrees of Freemasonry. So I was sort of in the process of going, you know, from the second to the third, and I had, there was a considerable amount of anxiety mounting, even though I didn't think I was going to be like sacrificed to Baphomet or anything like that. But, you know, whenever something's happening and you don't quite know exactly how it's going to go, you know, it's natural to have some amount of anxiety about it. So that's why that story comes out almost like a horror story. And then I wrote the ninth story. And also that story kind of emerges from not a dream that I had, but a dream that my dad had. I remember he told me when I was a kid, he told me about this dream he had that was very vivid, where he was like floating over this weird landscape. It was kind of like, he said it was almost like a toy city. All these like houses, they were big, but they, it was almost, he said they looked like they were fake, like they were like toys. And he was floating over them, and it was like this dead gray, weird city. And the lights were out and all these like weird little houses. And as he was floating over this gray spectral city, there was one house that had a light on in the second floor, and he started floating towards it. And then he woke up and he was gasping for breath. He couldn't breathe. And he wondered if he was actually having some sort of strange out-of-body experience as opposed to just having a dream. And so his description of that kind of strange twilight city went into the opening scene in Cryptopolis. So Cryptopolis kind of emerged from not a dream I had, but a dream that my dad had many years ago. The ninth story in the book, which is called Initiation, which was originally published by Rudy Rucker, cyberpunk legend Rudy Rucker. He had started a webzine called Flurb, FLURB, and he published this story, Initiation, which I wrote right after the third degree of Freemasonry. So it has a totally different tone than Cryptopolis. It's a little more, less of a horror story, I think, and more phantasmagoric, more dreamlike or surreal, I think. And there's other stories that deal with Freemasonry. There's a story called Dr. Apocrypha's Manifesto, which deals with the topic of Freemasonry in a kind of less metaphorical way. And there's also, there's a story called Bring Me the Head of André Breton, which was also published by Rudy Rucker. And it's kind of my absurdist meditation on the connections between ufology and surrealism. That whole story is about André Breton, the surrealist, the founder of surrealism, André Breton, being abducted by an extraterrestrial who has a spacecraft that has this kind of hyperdrive that can only be powered by surrealist poetry. So the alien has to abduct André Breton to provide fuel for this interstellar, interdimensional spacecraft.
Reminds me a little bit of the improbability drive, right?
Perhaps there's a kind of Douglas Adams connection there. I even though it's a kind of a silly, absurd story, there is I guess it is kind of a meditation on. I've always seen ufology as less a branch of science and more a branch of art or surrealism, or performance art, maybe. Sometimes, And I kind of, in a way, I kind of get into this in the Freemasons from Outer Space article, is that sometimes you get the sense that when you listen to these people talk about their contactee experiences, it's almost like they're an audience to some sort of strange performance art, some sort of odd avant-garde performance art that we can't possibly understand. And in a way, a lot of initiation ceremonies kind of have a performance art aspect to them. So even though Bring Me the Head of Andre Breton is kind of an absurdist, kind of silly science fiction story, on the other hand, there's kind of these interesting themes going on underneath, you know? And then if you're interested in the more outre aspects of JFK assassination theories, you might want to check out Adventures in the Head Wound, which is the only story in the book.
Oh, yeah.
If you look in the back of the book, you'll see where each of the stories originally appeared. And Adventures in the Head Wound is the only one that says that this story appears here for the first time, because that story was rejected by every magazine in existence. I think maybe like 200 publications rejected that story.
Why do you think that is? I read the story. I mean, I maybe can guess, but yeah. But why do you think they?
Back in the days, because I wrote that story I workshopped it at the Clarion Writers Workshop in 1996. In the Clarion Writers Workshop is it happens every year in Seattle, Washington, and it's 6 weeks, and a different professional science fiction writer teaches each week. So in 1996, I was 24, so I was the youngest person there that particular year. And one of the weeks was the final week was taught by Rachel Pollack, a brilliant science fiction writer. And in fact, she wrote this collection of stories called Burning Sky, which contains a story in it called Angel Baby, which I often used in my creative writing classes at CSU Long Beach. But I remember I workshopped the story back then, back in 1996. So I was submitting it on a regular basis from 1996
wow,
all the way to when this book was published in 2024. And so I was submitting it back when you actually had to take a physical manuscript, put it in a manila envelope, and then put that manila envelope in a larger manila envelope and mail it physically to the magazine. And one time the manuscript was returned to me ripped in half, which is wow, interesting. But the story is about this teenager named Gerald who comes into possession of some of the blades of grass from the grassy knoll, and he puts the blades of grass into a pipe and he smokes it. And this sends him hurtling back through time and space to the day of the JFK assassination. And his astral body is able to observe the events of that day. And the story is dedicated to the memory of Paul Krasner, who passed away a few years back. And in fact, the first chapter of my first book, Cryptoeschatology, was written at the request of Paul Krasner. And he wrote a book that I highly recommend called Confessions of a Raving Unconfined Nut, which is one of the best memoirs I've ever read. That title comes from Krasner got his FBI file, and in there, J. Edgar Hoover himself had called Paul Krasner a raving unconfined nut. So he decided to call his book Confessions of a Raving Unconfined Nut. And in that book, he talks about for years he edited a magazine called The Realist, which was like the premier satirical magazine in America from the 50s onward. And he wrote this famous or infamous piece called The Parts Left Out of the Kennedy Book. And you can read all about it in that memoir. But essentially it was In the late 60s, the journalist William Manchester wrote a book called The Death of a President, all about JFK. And so Krasner writes this piece that he claimed was a chapter edited out of Manchester's book. And he did like a really great job of mimicking Manchester's prose. And some people read this in Krasner's magazine, The Realist, and they thought they could detect exactly where in the Manchester book this chapter was supposed to go. And it was supposedly eyewitness testimony of unnamed sources on Air Force One who saw Lyndon Johnson fucking the wound in Kennedy's head right, you know, as he was being sworn in as president.
Yeah.
And Krasner said that the fact that so many people believed this said a lot about how much respect they had for Lyndon Johnson. But in the story, Adventures in the Head Wound, not only do you see that scene, but Charles Harrelson is in the story. That's Woody Harrelson's father, who claimed to have been involved in the JFK assassination, which is quite possible because Charles Harrelson was actually a hitman with underworld connections. And so he's in the story, and the Umbrella Man is a character in the story, and Lee Harvey Oswald makes a brief guest appearance. And so I think that maybe that scene, the head wound fucking scene, is the scene that caused the guy to rip the manuscript in half and mail it back to me.
Maybe that was the trigger for ripping it in half. But in general, I think, you're implying that it wasn't a lone shooter, right? I mean, that's also
right, that could have been it
indicated
as well.
in the
it's interesting. I almost missed the days where you actually submitted out physical manuscripts because like strange things like that would happen. I remember one time I submitted a story that's not in Cryptopolis, to this prominent horror magazine. And the main character of the story was a heroin addict, which describes most of the people I knew at that time. And the editor sent the story back in the self-addressed stamped envelope. And on the back of the manila envelope was a phone number scrawled in ink. And I thought, you know, what the hell? Did he use my envelope as like a piece of scratch paper or something? So just out of curiosity, I called the phone number, and it was a hotline to some rehab clinic. So I guess the editor like had a hard time distinguishing between fiction and nonfiction, and thought that I was actually, you know, that I must be a heroin addict because that was the character in the story, which maybe is like a testament to how good the story was, that, you know, he thought it was, you know, autobiographical, I guess. And oddly enough, years later, I actually sold a story to that same editor, but I never mentioned that earlier incident, and I doubt he remembers it anyway. I kind of missed those days. But in Cryptopolis, there's also there's the final story in the book, Esther Shadow's Glass Silence. That's the second story I ever sold. It appeared in a magazine called The Third Alternative, which isn't around anymore. But that deals with the connections between the Kabbalah and quantum physics. And several of the stories, as I said, emerged directly from dreams. There's a story in there called The Sheet, which is probably one of the few stories I ever wrote that was entirely a dream. In other words, sometimes you'll have a dream and it might inspire a single scene or maybe a vague idea or a line of dialogue or something. But the story, The Sheet, which has a deceptively mundane title, emerged from a dream that I had in January of 2001. And when I woke from the dream, I wrote it all down in my dream journal. And in the dream, I remember I leapt out of bed, and I dashed into the hallway naked, and it's early in the morning, like maybe 6. And I go to the bathroom and I stuff my bed sheet down the toilet. And the sheet has the word sleep written all over it. Sleep, 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 sleep. And I keep flushing the toilet until the sheet like goes all the way down. And then this rumbling starts, and it, for some reason, it triggers an earthquake. And keep in mind, this is like a two-story apartment building, and the dream is happening in the exact apartment building where I was living at the time. So it was almost like, in my mind, it didn't feel like a dream at all. But the entire building, after I flush the sheet down the toilet, the entire building starts to slide or roll, and it rolls down the middle of the street. And then from the living room, you could see cars like swerving to avoid colliding with this building, which is suddenly immobile. And you could see like looks of fear and surprise on the drivers as they're trying to swerve out of the way of this building. And I don't think this was the intended result of flushing the sheet down the toilet. It was some sort of odd side effect. But for some reason, I had this overwhelming urge to stuff the sheet down the toilet. And so the building like is barreling down the middle of the street, and it's destroying all this private property. And there's like white picket fences and like houses and RVs and fire hydrants are just getting like pushed out of the way. And then the building hits the freeway, and somehow it slides up the on-ramp, even though it's like the building's too large to fit on the on-ramp, but somehow it slides up the on-ramp, and now it's on like the 405 heading north toward Santa Monica, toward the pier and the ocean. And I hear these helicopters overhead, and there's like a TV helicopter there. And I go up on the roof, and the copter sends down this like rope ladder. And me and this other tenant in the building, we just reject the ladder. We're like, no, go away. We don't want your ladder. And then we go down to this other guy's apartment, this other tenant, and we're listening to old radio shows. We decide to spend the last moments before we head directly into the sea listening to these old radio shows. And after about a half hour, the building starts to sink into the Pacific. And there are all these people trying to get up onto the roof with these rickety wooden ladders, but there's just too many people, and it's way too late, and they can't get up there, and the ladder just falls, and all these people just kind of like fall into the water as it's rising up to the second level of this apartment building. And me and the other guy, we don't even care. We just go back to the room. The other tenant turns on the TV. And it's just snow. So the tenant picks up the remote and hits 00. And on the 00 channel, you can tune into the dream that I was having before I woke up and started putting the sheet down the toilet. And this freaks out the other tenant. And he leaves and falls into the water, which is rising rapidly. And the entire building is lowering into the ocean. So now I have to make a decision. Do I drown or do I save myself by going into the TV screen and returning to this dream or nightmare that was disturbing me, that upset me at the beginning of this whole sequence? And so I jump into the TV screen, and I'm in this giant silk cocoon above a white marble staircase that spirals down into darkness, and you can tell that there's a lot of people at the bottom of the staircase, and there are spiders all over me, and I start to swing from side to side, and the thread snaps, and the whole cocoon just drops down and tumbles down the stairs and lands on this beach that's filled with like this tide, just filled with blood, and I crawl out of the cocoon kind of like the legless armless man from Todd Browning's Freaks, and I managed to, with my arms and broken legs, I'm able to crawl out of the cocoon, and I drown in this bloody sea, and then I woke up. So I wrote all that down in January of 2001, and then it became a published story in the fall of 2017. So sometimes these things have to wait around a bit and gestate.
So I guess that gives a good impression why I think it was one of the strangest collection of stories I ever read. Of course, there's also a selection from the Expectant Mother Disinformation Handbook, which is, well, you just have to read it, I guess. And The Loser, for example. Stories like that, that are just, you know, heartbreaking, to be honest. And show life in LA, I guess, you know, life in weird vicinity of LA or...
Almost all the stories take place in LA, Los Angeles or the environs of Los Angeles. And I always wanted to do a collection of stories that kind of volleyed back and forth rapidly between among different genres. So in the book, in Cryptopolis, you begin with the story Cryptopolis, and then from there
you descend.
It volleys back and forth between, you have very realistic stories, like you just mentioned, like The Loser.
Too realistic.
Yes, yeah. That story, of course, was inspired by a guy I knew in high school who murdered somebody in self-defense. And that I was at school, and I was there with Damien, who I later wrote about in Camellio. And me and Damien were at Cherry High, which was this correctional school. Damien and I had both gotten kicked out of Torrance High. Torrance High was the more respectable school. In fact, that's where they shot Beverly Hills 90210 and Buffy the Vampire Slayer was shot at Torrance High, because the real Beverly Hills high school is too small. So they had to find one that was larger. So they went to Torrance High and they filmed the show there. So if you've ever watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer, when I was watching that, when it was on in the late 90s, it was really weird watching it. And you see like Buffy staking a vampire, like in front of the fountain I used to hang out at all the time. You know, like, oh, that's where my girlfriend yelled at me in front of all my friends that day. You know, it's like a really weird cognitive dissonance kind of thing that happens. But I got kicked out. Me and Damien had to leave Torrance High and go to Cherry High, which was a correctional school. So it was like me, a bunch of gangbangers, and pregnant girls, and me, and Damien.
Oh my God.
We met this guy named Ned. One day after school, this guy named Ned comes up, and he has this other dude with him. And this other guy says, do you want to see a dead body? It was like right out of Stand By Me. And I thought that they were bullshitting. And Damien goes, nah. Damien's like, nah, we got to go somewhere else. They proceed to tell us the story about how Ned's friend said he was walking along PCH, Pacific Coast Highway, and this old white dude picked him up. You want to get into my van? And this guy, who's like 16, gets into the guy's van, and he claimed that this old rich white dude tried to molest him and actually like pulled a gun on him, and there was a tussle, and he grabbed the gun and he shot the guy. And he was driving around the van. He left the van parked behind a Vons, and they go, you want to go see the van? And we were like, nah, that's okay, we'll skip that one. And I was kind of like, as me and Damien were walking away, I was like, do you think they were serious? And Damien's like, I don't even want to know. I don't want to know if they're serious. Yeah. Which is probably the wisest move.
Very wise, yes.
And so I didn't see that guy again until several months later. I'm in my history class, and the newspaper is there, the Daily Breeze, which is the local Torrance newspaper. I open it up. There's an article about that guy, and he's in prison. and as I read the article, it talks about how they interview the dead man's family, and the daughter is like, oh, you know, this kid, this like gangbanger kid, he's lying about my father. My father would never do that. And I reflected back on the afternoon when he came up to us and was talking to us, and I realized there's like no reason for that guy to lie to us in that moment about what happened. I completely believe his version of the event. And that was like an early moment of, what appears in the newspaper is not necessarily representative of objective reality. What appears in the newspaper or what the courts decide are based entirely on factors that have nothing to do with reality. And so that was like an early epiphany. And I think that's why the story stuck with me for so long and eventually came out in the form of this story, which is kind of, I guess you could describe a crime noir, Southern California crime noir story. But as you say, it's also heartbreaking, the story, because the entire structure of society is against this guy who in the story, his name is Ernesto. That's the fictional name I gave the character, even though it's based on a real person. The entire way that society is structured is such that this guy has absolutely no way, no escape route. You know, he's like doomed from the first line onward. But that story appeared in a Black Cat Mystery Magazine, and I remember the editor Michael Bracken actually nominated it for a Derringer Award, which is the awards they give out to crime noir stories. You know. So that was cool that he liked it so much that he nominated it for that category. But that's on one end of the spectrum. There's other stories like The Lemon Thief and The Pharmacy, which are just entirely almost autobiographical. But then you'll get a story like The Detective with the Glass Gun. I have a student who read Cryptopolis, and he told me The Detective with the Glass Gun was going to remain with him for a long time. That story was inspired by, Scientology, partly, and a Frank Zappa song.
What a combination.
One of my favorite Frank Zappa albums is called Joe's Garage. A song on Joe's Garage, which is all about the Church of Appliantology. And the Church of Appliantology is these people who worship vacuum cleaners. And so I took that element of the Church of Appliantology and put that in the story. And so, and it also came out of, I met the Scientologist at this backyard barbecue back in around 2000, in Venice, California. And I met this guy who had been a Scientologist for 10 years. And he told me all these stories about how he worked at the Riverside facility. Scientologists have this facility in Riverside out in the middle of the desert where they film all their like training videos and stuff like that, their recruitment videos. And this guy said he was digging ditches for like 15 cents a day. And he said there was one day where he got sick, like really sick, like he had the flu, and he couldn't dig the ditches. So he was in bed. And they're like, hey, you got to get up and dig the ditches. And he's like, oh, I'm sick. And they go, we'll take care of that. And these Scientologists, supposedly, according to him, these Scientologists came in, they laid their hands on him. And then he said it was like a black ball of energy shot up out of his body and went flinging off into the stratosphere. And then he got up onto his feet and he was able to go out and dig the ditches. And so he... Now, later on, so he told me the story to illustrate, he said, why intelligent people get roped into this organization. So he said he was trying to tell me that there's a side of Scientology that where they actually know what they're doing, and this impresses people, and so then you get pulled deeper in. Now, I remember telling that story to Damien, and Damien said, you know what, they probably just like shot him up with like cocaine or something.
He's a very down to earth guy, Damien.
Yes,
although he's a junkie, but he's a down to earth junkie, which is an interesting combination. Yeah, and of course there is the show Camellio that we did, where you can learn a lot about Damien, and I totally recommend the book, by the way.
Absolutely, you'll learn all about Damien in Camellio, and I think that what he said is, he goes, what the effects that guy described, I could easily replicate that with cocaine. Like they probably just shot him up with him not knowing it.
The black ball shooting out, well, that might be difficult to replicate, but yeah.
That's true.
But you always leave out things that don't fit your theory. That's also true. That's also, by the way, what happens with abductees. You know, their stories are always cleansed of all the little dirty details that wouldn't fit to extraterrestrials.
Absolutely. That's why when I wrote Chameleo, I made sure to follow the advice of John A. Keel. John A. Keel said that there are these odd, weird, ridiculous, absurd details that will crop up when you go and investigate UFO phenomena, and that very often UFO investigators will leave out those details because they're afraid it'll make the whole thing seem ridiculous. But John Keel said that very often those are the most important details. And so when I wrote Chameleo, there are things that I could have removed because they seem insane. But I decided, no, I have to leave all those things in. And John Keel was absolutely right. Like later on, talking to other people, suddenly, you know, something that seems absurd, suddenly you got someone who you've never met before saying, no, that happened to me as well. I have to say, since we're both Art Bell aficionados, one thing I admired about Linda Moulton Howe is in her reports, she would often leave in those details. I remember one particular one where because Linda Moulton Howe would always do the reports at the beginning of Dreamland, and she was interviewing a guy who claimed that he had encountered Bigfoot up in the Pacific Northwest. And the guy told this whole story about how he was hiking along, and then suddenly, tumbling down the hillside, came this big, hairy beast. And boom, it falls onto the path right in front of him. And at first he thinks it's a bear. And the thing kind of like emerges, stands on its hind legs, and then turns around. And then suddenly he realizes, no, this is not a bear. And he described in great detail the layers of hair and the texture, what it looked like. And it turned around and it wasn't a bear. It looked more like what he had heard a Bigfoot look like. And the thing like looked at him and then turned around and walked away from him. And the guy just stood there watching it walk away. And he thought, oh no, this is the only trail out of here. So he has to like follow the thing or go back in the opposite direction, which will take him deeper into the woods. So he's like, I have to follow the thing. So he starts walking in the same direction. After a few minutes, the thing turns around and sees that the guy's following him and just suddenly like charges at him. And the guy described running down the side of the hill and crawling it, burrowing into a little hole, a little cave, and watching this thing zigzag back and forth across the hill, just pushing trees out of the way. This thing is like going down the hill trying to look for him. But the detail that Linda Moulton Howe left in that sticks in my mind to this day was he said, as he was standing there on the road and they were looking at each other, he said, this silver cone emerged from the Bigfoot's neck, and it had a servo whine to it, like and kind of twirled around and then went back into its neck. And then the Bigfoot turned around and walked away. And I thought, that's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
I love the detail of the silver cone with the servo whine emerging from Bigfoot's neck. I love that.
And I mean, how would you ever get to the bottom of anything if you leave out parts of the facts? I mean, you know, it's very strange. And
well, that's true. Well, of course, there are a lot of ufologists that go into it already having a theory.
Yeah, they already know what it is. They just search then for proof of what they already know. And right. that is misleading them, I think. But, you know,
yes.
Do I know? Ultraterrestrials, who is the blogger that also wrote a very interesting article about Vilas Boas that we also will be talking about, today, hopefully. Here's an interesting question. What does the author say about the parallels between UFO encounters and DMT experiences, especially regarding the, in quotes, entities? And that's all, that was always something. I mean, when I first heard, when I first heard that people see gray beings on DMT, that really got me thinking.
Yes, that's interesting. Rick Strassman, I believe, is the man who wrote DMT, the spirit molecule. And in fact, there's a whole documentary called DMT, the spirit molecule, based on the book, which I think you can see on Netflix. And he did the first actually government-funded study on the effects of psychedelics since, you know, the 1950s, because at a certain point in the 60s, they were outlawed, and so you couldn't do any legitimate scientific research with psychedelics. But Rick Strassman did with DMT, and he would take two different subjects who didn't know each other, put them in two separate rooms simultaneously, and give them DMT at the same time, and then the two subjects would report what they had seen during their hallucinations, if you even want to call them that. And very often these DMT experiences would sync up. These two people who didn't know each other, didn't know of either's existence, would have the same DMT experience at the same time, and sometimes would see each other in the other, like, DMT realm, which is impressive. I mentioned in Cryptopolis, there's a story called The Infant Kiss. That was the first story I ever published. It was in a collection called Aftershocks, edited by Jeremy Layson, and it was a collection of horror stories set in Southern California. And so there was a book signing for the anthology at a bookstore in San Diego, and I went there, and it was in the year 2000 at some point. I remember it was Ray Bradbury's birthday. I know that. Whatever Ray Bradbury's birthday is, that was the day the signing was. Because at the signing was Dennis Etchison, a legendary short story writer, Dennis Etchison, who's written The Blood Kiss and Dark Country and many other books. And George Clayton Johnson, who wrote for the original Twilight Zone, was there. And I ended up going to a coffee shop next door with Dennis Etchison and George Clayton Johnson. And we're sitting there, and I knew that Dennis Etchison was pretty much the only horror writer who remained in contact with Whitley Strieber. Because, as you know, Whitley Strieber was a best-selling horror writer before he wrote Communion. He wrote The Wolfen. He wrote The Hunger. War Day was a best-selling science fiction novel. When he published Communion, all those science fiction horror writers just turned their backs on it. Tom Dish wrote this scathing attack on Whitley Strieber in, I think, The Atlantic or something like that. So they all just Whitley Strieber, he got canceled before there was cancel culture.
He got canceled by the UFO community, right? I mean,
yes, that's right. You know, then the UFO people hated him. Mm-hmm. So he's must have tough skin. I saw an interview on Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect once where Whitley Strieber was absolutely excoriated by both Bill Maher and Michael Shermer of Skeptic Magazine. And he was getting like tag teamed by these guys and somehow emerged from it unscathed. But it would be difficult to be Whitley Strieber. I think, but one of the only horror writer who remained friends with Whitley Strieber, as far as I know, was Dennis Etchison. So here I am at this coffee shop with him, and I wanted to talk to him about Whitley Strieber, which he was surprised by. Dennis Etchison was also friends with Terrence McKenna, who of course wrote The Archaic Revival and True Hallucinations, and was an expert in DMT and psychedelics. And so Etchison said that he actually got Whitley Strieber and Terence McKenna together to talk to one another about the similarities between their experiences, which I found fascinating. And I remember I told Dennis Etchison something he did not know, which was that William S. Burroughs was impressed by Whitley Strieber's communion and actually contacted him. And Whitley Strieber spent a weekend with William Burroughs at Whitley Strieber's cabin in upstate New York, where the abductions had occurred. William Burroughs wanted to go there and see if he could interact. You know, like, if I go there, maybe I'll see the aliens. You know, I guess nothing.
Careful
happened.
What you wish for, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, it's interesting if you read the introduction to I Think It's Queer, which was just recently made into a film starring Daniel Craig. Daniel Craig's the only actor who played both Ian Fleming's James Bond and William S. Burroughs's William Lee. That's a good range. But in the introduction to Queer, William S. Burroughs, he briefly mentions that when he was a kid, he would see these little gray men who would appear in his this dollhouse that he had, this toy house. So I, you know, Burroughs had a lot of odd experiences himself, so I could see why he would be interested in Whitley Strieber's experiences. So I remember Dennis Etchison was taken aback by this. He had never heard this. He was not aware that Whitley Strieber had gone to that William Burroughs had gone to Whitley Strieber's cabin. And I told him, I go, well, it's in a book called Report from the Bunker. And he goes, I have that book. I don't remember that being in there. And I realized that Report from the Bunker was originally published in the 70s. And then later, I think in the 90s, there was an updated edition. If you get the updated version, in the back is the whole section that talks about William S. Burroughs going to Whitley Strieber's cabin. So I think Etchison didn't have this, you know, later updated revised edition, which is why he wasn't aware of it. But if you get an edition of Whitley Strieber's novel Billy, on the back there's actually a quote, a blurb from William S. Burroughs. That Dennis Etchison himself had seen the correlation between what Terence McKenna was talking about with the self-replicating machine elves and his ayahuasca experiences. And Etchison had seen the parallels between that and what Whitley Strieber was talking about and decided to kind of get them together for a meeting of the minds. I wish that conversation had been recorded. I'd like to eavesdrop on that conversation.
I can imagine, yeah. And I mean, anyone who read or tried to read, as I did, Naked Lunch, I think I gave up kind of half through the book, I think can understand that William Burroughs must have had a lot of very strange experiences. I mean, you don't, or at least vivid dreams about extremely strange stuff. So there might be a parallel to you.
I was very pleased. Philip Fracassi compared the blurb on the cover of Cryptopolis. Fracassi compares the stories to both William S. Burroughs and Samuel Delaney, which is a huge compliment. But yes, Burroughs was a huge influence going back to high school, and definitely Burroughs, his writing overlaps with high strangeness, the paranormal, parapolitics. If you read his book The Job, which is nonfiction, as early as the 70s, he's already talking about the effects of like biological warfare, covert biological warfare experiments and their effects on the American population. So Burroughs was clearly interested in this kind of stuff going way back. And even if you read his collection of letters, he's already talking about, you know, Wilhelm Reich and Reich's interest in UFOs.
Okay.
So Burroughs was plugged into this going way back, like even before Naked Lunch, I think.
Ultra-terrestrials asks, rumors persist that as a child, and I've read those rumors in Supernatural, by the way. It really surprised me. So rumors persist that as a child, Strieber may have been involved in a project bearing unsettling parallels to MK Ultra. He describes, as far as I remember, being locked up in a cage. So I think his father or his uncle, I think who was high up in the military, he took him to an Air Force base or something like that, some base. He was like 7 years old, and he and other kids were locked up in a cage. Can you remember this passage in Supernatural, if you read that one?
Yes, it might even be referenced in The Secret School.
Uh-huh.
As well. It's interesting because since having published Chameleo, I've been in contact with a lot of different people. And one element that keeps coming up, and not all of them, but in maybe some of the more interesting cases, to the point where I started asking them this question, and that is that a lot of them, when they were children, were put into what was called the gifted program. And that was presented to the parents as a kind of like advanced AP class, like advanced English, advanced mathematics. These students were getting grades higher than the other students. So they were kind of put into this special program, kind of like an after-school special program, almost presented as like a college prep course or something. But then when they would get there, the teachers would say things like, okay, what do I have in my pocket? Can you tell me the shape? We put something in a bank vault across town. Can you tell us what it might be? So there's all these questions that involve like psychic phenomena.
A remote viewing training or a remote viewing recursion course.
Absolutely. And it's interesting how far back this goes. Because one of the first people to interview me about Chameleo was Tessa Dick, the widow of Philip K. Dick, the famous legendary science fiction writer who wrote Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which became Blade Runner and so many other novels. And Tessa Dick said Chameleo fascinated her because it paralleled experiences that she and Phil Dick had had in Orange County back in the 70s. And
really?
if you read A Scanner Darkly, which of course was made into a film with Keanu Reeves and Winona Ryder, Robert Downey Jr., the plot of that book is all about a narc. He's a Bob Arctor, he's a police officer, but has infiltrated the kind of drug underground of Southern California, and it's set slightly in the future. And he wears this thing called a blur suit, which is essentially kind of like an optical camouflage, like skin tight suit that obscures your identity. And there's a whole aspect of the plot where he's taking this drug called Substance D that literally like splits his brain, his consciousness into two. So it's at a certain point, he doesn't realize that he's narking on himself. And I remember even having this conversation with Damien while the events of Chameleo were unfolding. Damien at one point said, you know, I almost feel like these people, they read a bunch of Phil Dick novels and then decided to make them reality. And he said, I wish Phil Dick had written happier novels. You know, maybe if he'd written like utopian novels, they would have decided to bring those into being. And when I told Tessa Dick that, she was very amused. But when I was on her show, which is called Ancient of Days, there was one point where I kind of started interviewing her. And she starts telling me about how when she was a child, she was in this gifted program. And she said they took her and about 15 other students, and she grew up in Southern California. They took her to this room, and the John, which was the name of the adult instructor, was like, oh, I have something in my pocket. What is it? Can you guess the shape? Or, you know, we put something in a bank vault across town. Can you tell us what it was? But all that whole thing. And her brother was also in the same program. Then she told me, oh, yes, Phil told me he was in the same type of program. So first of all, you have to understand that Phil Dick was born in 1928 and he died in 82. So 1928, so let's say when he was 10, that's 1938. So that goes back to the late 30s. And there's a writer named S. William Snyder, Steve Snyder, who does a podcast called The Farm. And he just published a book that I recommend called Weird Tales, Zizians, Crypto, and Demiurges on the Cloud. I'm reading this book right now. But Steve Snyder did a whole episode of his podcast, The Farm, back in, like, I think 2023, where he claimed, and he had evidence to back this up, that Michael Aquino, who is sort of an infamous figure in parapolitics, because he wrote the psychological warfare paper Mind War, which was featured in William Cooper's Behold a Pale Horse. So a lot of people know who Colonel Michael Aquino is for that reason. Colonel Michael Aquino's mother, whose name was Betty Ford, not the Betty Ford Clinic, different Betty Ford, Betty Ford Aquino. He claimed that Betty Ford Aquino was patient zero in this gifted program. And that the guy who started the program, whose name I believe was Lewis Terman, that it all grew out of this whole sort of Darwinian notion of genetics and identifying who are the most gifted children, and we're gonna, you know, mate them with other gifted children, and then we'll have like a superior race. It's all, you know, it's all like really crazy ideologies that, you know, later feed into Nazi Germany. But so according to Steve Snyder, this gifted program goes all the way back to the 20s. And in fact, Phil Dick and Aquino's mother would have been around the same age, which makes it, I think, plausible to me that Phil Dick was, in fact, in a similar program. And Tessa Dick told me that when Phil Dick got older, he just told him to get lost. Like he didn't want to be involved in their little studies anymore. But I have a feeling that these were longitudinal studies, meaning they were generational. You know, they would study you and then your children. And so I have a feeling they probably kept tabs on Phil as he progressed, became a science fiction writer. And a lot of the experiences he had in the 70s, like with the mysterious pink beam that hit him in the forehead, and he had these kind of strange experiences that were either mystical experiences, or were they interactions with extraterrestrials, or was he the victim of a mind control program? You know, he himself never knew exactly what it was that had happened to him. I think it's very possible that those events, which later inspire his novel, his masterpiece, Valis, published just before he died, I think that those mysterious events are somehow tied in with this gifted program that he was in. And a lot of the people who have contacted me after reading Camellio, they've had similar experiences when they were kids. So this experience goes from the late 20s all the way on well into the 80s and 90s.
But it's something different to being tested. And by the way, it's quite interesting that you mentioned that they also test the children, because also abductions run in families, right? So if your parents have been an abductee, so you're quite likely to become one too, or at least more likely than someone else.
Well, yes. You know, I mean, we were talking about, you know, ufologists who have their theory already mapped out, and so they just remove anything that violates the theory. I remember talking to Melinda Leslie, who, you know, claims to be an alien abductee, and also to have what she calls my lab experiences. Of course, my lab meaning military abduction. So first you're abducted by what appears to be extraterrestrials, and then later you're abducted by humans, right? Or, you know, military looking people
trying to find out what happened.
Trying to find out what happened, right? Reverse engineering. They're very interested in the technology. What did the spaceship look like? How was it piloted? You know, explain the technology to us. It's all about, you know, like replicating technology. And very often the MyLab experiencers will describe their MyLab military abduction as being far more horrifying than what happened with the supposed extraterrestrials, which I think says something interesting about human beings. But when Melinda would talk to, say, like Bud Hopkins about these experiences, Bud Hopkins would say, oh, yes, you know, I've had those reports. I always leave those out because he didn't want to deal with that because it muddied the waters. Like if suddenly he starts talking about experiences of human beings being present during the alien abduction, well, now you're opening the door to, is this some sort of mind control program or, you know, but, and so he thought that it was going to make the whole thing look ridiculous if he includes stories about human beings being present during the abduction, but you're not supposed to leave out data.
Yeah, there we go again. It's the same thing. It's quite a shame. So pretty much most of them did it. But coming back to this Whitley Strieber episodes, being locked in a box is something different than being tested for remote viewing capabilities. So what do you make of Whitley's account of being locked in a box and they were scared, I think he describes? What's that for?
You know, what do you make of so many of Whitley Strieber's memories? I have to say that I've never met Whitley Strieber, though we have mutual acquaintances. I've always considered Whitley Strieber to be sincere. I've never thought that he was lying.
No,
I think that he's. I mean, you might say he's confused. He's the first to admit that he's confused. I mean, he's often said, "I don't know if these are aliens. I have no idea."
And that's the truth. He has no idea, and so doesn't anyone else.
Right. And he's the first to admit, "I don't know what's going on." But he is kind of like this weird vortex of high strangeness. I mean, and sometimes what's amazing is, particularly if you would listening to him doing his Dreamland shows when he was interviewing other people, he would be talking and then just nonchalantly mention something that was just absolutely mind-blowing. but it was almost like he himself wasn't aware of the significance of it. One time he was interviewing Peter Lavenda, who wrote Unholy Alliance, and many other books, and he just casually mentions that when he was a young man in his early 20s, he went to England and he hung out with the final church of the process church, which figures into the whole, you know, Charles Manson mythos, because Ed Sanders wrote the book The Family, where he was trying to tie in Charles Manson with this cult called the Process Church of the Final Judgment. And then they show up again in Maury Terry's book, The Ultimate Evil, later on, which attempts to connect the Son of Sam killings with Charles Manson. And the Process Church sued Ed Sanders, by the way. So later editions of The Family remove any mention of the church. And Whitley Strieber just mentions casually that when he was in his early 20s, oh, I went to England and I hung out at the Process Church for like a couple of months. And I remember listening to that going, wait, what? But, you know, I'd never heard that before. And then he has memories of being at the University in Austin on the day that Charles Whitman took out all those people. You know, he was like one of the early mass shooters, right? You know, one of the early snipers was Charles Whitman, who was a Marine who went to the top of the water tower at the Texas University and just started picking off people and killed like 16 random victims. And Willie Streamer claimed that he was there that day. Then later on, he said, you know, it's weird. I guess some journalists like looked into it and found that there's like no possible way that Streber could have been there that day. And then later on, Streber was like, yeah, what's weird is I remember it. And again, when that may sound like somebody who's like lying or prevaricating, but I always get the sense that he's completely sincere about the experiences. That may not necessarily mean that what he's describing aligns with objective reality, you know, but that he's being completely sincere about what he remembers.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think I quote Willie Streber in the Freemasons from Outer Space article talking about the mysterious like 9 sets of knocks that were occurring in his cabin after some of his abduction experiences, which I tie into the Masonic symbolism from the Antonio Villaboas abduction. But Streber, his experiences, I think, are very interesting. And I'm very interested in the religious symbolism that's tied in with his experiences. I mean, if you look at the books from the perspective of a mythological or religious perspective, I mean, the first book is called Communion, Transformation, and Confirmation. So these are all like stages of Catholicism, you know, Communion, Transformation, Confirmation.
Yeah.
And Streber is, you know, a lapsed Catholic, I believe. So I've always wondered, like, is that symbolism like conscious, you know, or I mean, is he purposely weaving that in, or is that something that's totally unconscious? And in fact, if you read Confirmation, it's interesting that in there, he actually brings up the whole, I don't know if he brings up Mylabs specifically, but he opens the door to the whole topic of mind control, perhaps having something to do with his experiences. Unlike Bud Hopkins, Willie Streber was actually open to analyzing that idea. And he talks about experiences in there that certainly sound like MyLab kind of experiences.
I mean, the episode that he had as a child, so this traumatization of those kids, that ride fits into this.
It certainly does. I mean, if that memory...
If that's a real memory, of course, yeah. If that's
a real memory, that certainly does sound like some sort of trauma-based programming or something
definitely,
similar to that.
Yeah. I mean, so abduction as a Masonic ritual, the opening of the mind, as you write, to a new set of symbols. So that's I think, at the core of these parallels, right? So abduction experiences as well as Masonic rituals should open the mind to a new set of symbols. What does that mean?
Well, you know, it's interesting that, of course, Freemasonry is all about symbolism. One of the reasons I was drawn towards it, because as Ray Bradbury said, you can have an idea, but if you don't have the metaphor, you don't have anything. You can have a plot, but if you don't have the metaphor, then you don't really have a story, because a story is like a plot and the metaphor both, you know, combining into one thing. And so when I was very young, I noticed that a lot of the writers I was reading, particularly in the late Victorian era, late 1800s, early 1900s, this kind of Masonic or Hermetic symbolism shows up in a lot of their writing, including H. Rider Haggard or even L. Frank Baum, who was a theosophist. There's a lot of theosophical symbolism in the Wizard of Oz and the subsequent Oz books. Edgar Rice Burroughs, the Princess of Mars, the Mars novels. Barry, a lot of theosophical symbolism there. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, very much interested in theosophy. A lot of that type of symbolism in H. Rider Haggard, Jules Verne. So I noticed that, and so I wanted to know more about that, you know. And what was it that was drawing these writers to these esoteric orders, right? And so I remember reading, I can't remember which Jacques Vallée book it was. It might be Dimensions. I think it is Dimensions. There's a one particular passage, and I think I quote it in the Freemasons from Outer Space article, which appeared in New Dawn magazine, special issue volume 18, number 5, so October 2024, last year. I quote a passage from this Vallée book where he talks about, he just mentions almost in passing at one point that after having examined a lot of these UFO reports, that a lot of them seem to him to be similar to secret society initiations. The types of things that happen during an initiation are similar to the kinds of things that happen to alien abductees or alien contactees. And I think I had that in the back of my mind when I was reading this book by Jim and Coral Lorenzen. And in that book, there's this one chapter that deals specifically with Antonio Villa-Boas, and who's one of the early, you know, alien contactees / abductees. And as I was reading this,
isn't he the earliest? I mean, are there any known cases prior to 1957 of classical alien abduction experiences?
I don't know of any. Maybe someone else can.
Betty and Barney Hill, that was in 61. Kay Bender, Kay Bender, was he? No, I think he was also. But no, I think Kay Bender, didn't he say that his experience happened in the 40s? Or am I mistaken?
I think he did say it happened earlier than Boas, but I think his account was published later. So there's some, you know, question there. But the Boas incident is, I think, first reported. And it could be that there are earlier ones, of course, but I think it's sort of, you know, it's kind of like, you know, Kenneth Arnold's flying saucer sighting isn't probably not the first. But it's the first, it's the where we mark the beginning of the modern era of, you know, UFOs. And so I think you could say that it's the first significant one, you know, it's the first alien abduction experience that makes a mark, you know, on the field. And so for that reason, it's interesting analyzing it just from that perspective alone. But also when I was reading it, these kind of elements of Masonic symbolism started leaping out at me from the report. And I know that one could say, oh, well, you know, if you're looking for something, you're going to find it. It's like Darren Aronofsky's film Pi, where they have a whole conversation about, you know, if suddenly you fixate on one thing, you're going to start seeing it all over the place. But in this particular case, I would say that doesn't apply, because I've actually looked for it in other places and I don't see it. it stood out in this particular account because it was so overwhelmingly ripe with Masonic symbolism. But the report about the Villa-Boas incident was written in 1958 by a man named Dr. Olavo Fontes, who was a professor of medicine at the National School of Medicine in Brazil, and him and this journalist wrote up the report, and it predates Betty and Barney Hill by several years. And Villa-Boas was a 23-year-old Brazilian farmer, and on Wednesday, October 16th, 1957, at like 1 a.m., he's out, you know, on his tractor in the field, and this flying saucer lands in front of him. And by the way, it's interesting. That was a Wednesday. I mentioned that because John Keel claimed that more UFO activity happened on Wednesday than any other day of the week.
And I think it's like 10:30 p.m. or that's also,
I think it was early in the morning. So it was like, it was like 1 a.m. The quote, by the way, the quote from Ballet, it is from Dimensions. And he says, "Is this confusion technique deliberately used to effect change on a major scale? Answering such questions could also help us to understand the strong resemblance that anyone who has examined the beliefs of esoteric groups could not fail to note between certain UFO encounters and the initiation rituals of secret societies. This opening of the mind to a new set of symbols that is reported by many witnesses is precisely what the various occult traditions also try to achieve." So that was the passage that leapt out of me back when I read Dimensions, which I think I read at some point in the mid-90s. But that was the quote that came back to me as I was reading this report about Via Boas. But even his name itself is interesting because in the Masonic lodge, there's two pillars, and one of them is Boaz, which means unity. So his name literally means like houses of unity. And his encounter happened in the early morning hours of October 16th, and that was just less than 2 weeks after the launch of Sputnik. So on a symbolic level, Sputnik is like piercing the veil between worlds and kind of initiating the deterioration of the boundaries between nations, right? Which was certainly a outgrowth of the kind of universalist Masonic philosophies. But the symbolism of the three men, the three ruffians, which is a part of first degree Masonic initiations, you get that in the abduction. You get the three men, the three beings appear, and
aren't it four beings initially when they get out of this egg-shaped craft that lands on three tripods?
Right. Well, initially, he sees three, and then later he realizes there's four. But his initial impression is that there are three, and then that leapt out at me because there's the three. The craft has these three kind of it's like a tripod, you know. And then when he gets inside, he describes that there's like these three cornered metal plates on their helmets, and there's these like three kind of silver metal tubes coming out of their forehead. And then there's a clock inside that keeps time in 3 hour increments, and they take him into this windowless room, which is similar to Masonic lodges that have no windows inside. And then he describes there are these three poles inside. When he gets out, he mentions specifically that he doesn't sleep for like 3 days. And on the third day, he's able to go to sleep. Then there's all the symbolism with the Masonic ladder and the great chain of being that I make a reference to that. They're making signs at him, these odd signs with their hands, which are sort of analogous to Masonic hand signals. There's all this interesting fairy tale symbolism. I mean, you know, the whole story of like Rip Van Winkle is obviously redolent with this kind of ultra-terrestrial imagery. I mean, the story is about a guy who goes to sleep in a fairy circle inside a crop circle, and then these little men take him underground, and they give him this sweet substance to drink, and he falls asleep, and he has missing time, you know. And that's the story of Rip Van Winkle, right? And Antonio Villaboas mentions that the shoes of his abductors look like those described in the fairy tales of old. You know, that was like the actual language he used. And then the three, he's left with these three people or whatever, and they spread this liquid all over him. with this something that's like a wet sponge. And he describes the liquid as clear as water, but much thicker and odorless, which is very similar to Bender's story that he tells in Flying Saucers and the Three Men, where three beautiful women do this the same thing to him. Again, there's like parallels there with the kind of fairy nectar that puts you to sleep in the fairy tales. And the Via Boas's claims was reported to this doctor in 58, but doesn't appear in print until June 1962 of a Brazilian UFO periodical. So what's interesting is that Albert K. Bender's account, even though he claimed it happened before, it's published later. So there's kind of like an overlap there. I don't think there was an opportunity for Albert Bender to read this Brazilian UFO article while he was working on his book. You know what I mean? I think it would be Via Boas's report was not known until later. So it's almost as if that the events are happening almost simultaneously. But what's interesting is that later on, there was a reporter who I quote in here, who went back and interviewed Via Boas's sister. And she claimed that Antonio received a visit from five men dressed in green uniforms who compelled him to travel with them to the United States. So this is Via Boas's 70-year-old sister speaking many years later. She said, "Some of these men spoke Portuguese, others English. I think they were from NASA. They kept visiting several times over 8 or 10 years. They would always give my brother books written in English as gifts. He was subjected to questioning and the lie detector in California. He was taken to an open area where the remains of a flying saucer could be found. They then showed him another in good condition inside an enclosed area like a museum, asked him if it was identical to the one he had seen. He told me that it was very similar. He was always accompanied by a journalist who had a foreign name and acted as an interpreter and was always surrounded by uniformed American personnel. He was in the United States for 3 days," and we get the three again. "They later gave him two properties near San Francisco and San Rafael. I managed to see the deeds. They sent him back to Rio, where he spent between 15 and 20 days in the hospital undergoing new examination and tests. This affected him greatly, it seems. According to the medical report, Antonio was in excellent mental health and not crazy. He didn't like the subject to be made public. He was always very discreet and didn't want to discuss his experiences. But one day he received an offer from a famous television personality and he accepted, but NASA kept him from appearing." And so I was wondering if, because the reason I took Via Boas' story seriously is because I recognize the obvious Masonic symbolism that's kind of contained within it. So I wonder if at the time these people who came to visit him, maybe they also noticed the same thing, you know, and were interested in talking to him about that. I also quote a book by Jeffrey Hodson, who was a Freemason. And many years ago, around 2003, I was dating this young woman who was a co-Mason. Co-Masons can be both men and women. And I was in Freemasonry. So we were kind of comparing notes. And she gave me this book to read. She goes, "Read this book." And I go and I read it. And as I'm reading it, I come across this passage where the author, and this was like an old book written in the early 1900s. And this writer starts talking about how there was this Masonic initiation where these little men appeared during the initiation and they started following the initiates around the lodge, mimicking their hand gestures. And I thought, well, that's wild. But it just like went to the back of my mind and I forgot about it. Then as I was writing this article, I suddenly remembered. I was like, man, what was that book? And for some reason, I was absolutely certain it was a C.W. Leadbeater book. And I went through every single C.W. Leadbeater book in my library, and I couldn't find this goddamn passage about the little gnomes showing up in the Masonic Lodge, and it was driving me crazy. So finally, I thought, who the hell would know the answer to this question? So I emailed Richard Smoley, who's an expert in esotericism. And I said, hey, look, I read this book back 20 years ago. And there was this passage about these like little men that appeared during a Masonic initiation. I thought it was C.W. Leadbeater, but I can't find it. Do you know like where this might appear? And Richard Smoley said, he goes, I don't know, but let me ask someone who might know. So he asked his friend, and the friend said, that sounds like Jeffrey Hodson. And it was. I had completely misremembered it as being a C.W. Leadbeater book. It was a book called At the Sign of the Square and Compass by Jeffrey Hodson. And in that book, he talks about, in fact, there's two paragraphs where this description appears. He says, if the junior deacon does not command the respect of these little people who suddenly appear, they will laugh and mimic him and the candidate. In fact, the gnomes are amused by most of the ceremony, except at those times when its force arrests them, when they become serious for the time being. The gnomes play about the temple
That's
floor.
That's so strange that it's the force of the ritual suddenly arrests them. And sorry, but this whole description of gnomes popping up in these rituals. I mean, this totally reminds me of seances, when also those, you know, kind of reminds me of seances, where in some instances, allegedly also beings materialize somehow, you know, or tulpas or whatever.
Yeah, like ectoplasmic beings.
Yeah.
Yeah. It says, the gnomes play about the temple floor, march with grotesque and absurd mimicry behind the procession, and follow the journeys, thoroughly enjoying themselves all the time and really getting much fun out of the ceremony. They are a superior kind of gnome, in a way properly representative of their race, sent by their superiors in that capacity. They are not always so dark as the gnomes found in natural surroundings in the outer world, and have not their unpleasant or hostile appearance. These gnomes might be called ceremonial gnomes. They are dressed in an imitation of our Masonic clothes, generally in bright colors, vivid red and green being the most common. Some attempt evening dress for a few moments, but it cannot be said to be very successful. I like that line. Some attempt evening dress for a few moments. It's as if the clothes are like appearing on them, mm-hmm. like out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And then apparently some of these little people stay in the temple, as I have noticed them, before the ceremony starts, and frequently join the procession on entrance, following the right worshipful master through the two lines of officers, sometimes with a right worshipful master of their own, with deacons and staff complete. I have not usually noticed more than three gnomes at a time in the temple, though there may be more. Again, we get the recurrence of the number three. So I think that's fascinating for various reasons. Of course, they're using the word gnome, because this book was, of course, published in the early
Oh, and here he's gone. Okay, I don't really know why, but I will try to give him a call. This happens sometimes. So let's see. I'm going to play a little song and try to get Robert back.
Ride stand still. Little did we ever know the game is on. The curtain's gonna fall
on a day like this. On a day like this. On a day like this. On a day like this.
Yeah, so I'm afraid Robert is not picking up his phone and he's also not joining the session again. Which is bad, I have no idea. I mean, of course the phone would have been the backup, but he's neither joining the session nor picking up his phone, nor, I'm going to call him again, nor is he answering me on Zoom. He's kind of gone. Also Robert ist irgendwie wie vom Erdboden verschluckt. Er hebt weder sein Telefon ab, noch antwortet er auf Zoom, auf Chat und er steigt auch nicht mehr in die 3CX-Session ein. Ich habe keine Ahnung, warum. Ah, Moment, hier ist er. Robert, hi.
Yeah, yes, I don't know what happened.
I have no idea neither, and you weren't picking up your phone, so. But can you get into the 3CX session again, or should we maybe just continue on the phone for now?
Let me try to get back in.
Yeah,
I'm going to try to get back on. I don't know how, why it suddenly disconnected. I think I was talking for a long time and didn't realize you weren't there anymore.
Yeah, so, try to get back in right now, or maybe I'll play another song. Sorry, guys, but we need to straighten that out here. So, okay, I'm going to play another song, and then, oh, there you are. I can see you in the session. So I think you should be back. Robert, can you hear me? Okay, I can't hear you on the session anymore. Maybe your microphone.
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, you can hear me. Okay. So,
yes.
Great. Then let's continue. I don't know. Where have we been?
What was I saying when I got disconnected?
Honestly,
I don't remember.
I also can't remember right now. So we were, but okay, we were at those threes. That was something that you were mentioning. So Whitley, keeps mentioning those knocks of threes, and I remembered the threes. There is also a Star Trek episode. It's called Cause and Effects. And do you know it?
No.
So they kind of are in a loop. It's recurring trees remind them that they are stuck in a loop, and this loop always ends with destruction. And then somehow they remind themselves with those trees, and then at the end get out of it, which I thought is a very interesting plot. You know, so they are in a loop of destruction. That kind of sounds familiar, doesn't it? And threes save them.
That's interesting. It's almost like it's like in Inception, where they have a the little totem that will remind them that they're in a kind of virtual reality or dream scenario. In fact, I have a my next book coming out is called Hollywood Haunts the World: An Investigation into the Cinema of Occulted Taboos, So there's a whole, the first chapter is about kind of esoteric Gnostic symbolism in cinema, particularly starting with, well, it goes all the way back to the 1920s, but I'm focusing on a specific period of a kind of resurgence in such filmmaking, beginning with Dark City in the late 90s and then going through The Matrix and all the way up till now, and including Inception. Hollywood Haunts the World will be out in November, published by Head Press in England. But I kind of analyze the TV shows and films where this kind of symbolism crops up. And sometimes, you know, it's probably unconscious on the part of the filmmakers, but sometimes it's probably intentional. Did I mention common side effects before I got disconnected?
No, but I think we were talking about those gnomes. I think that's one of the last...
Right, the gnomes. Okay, so there's this TV show called Common Side Effects. It's animated. Have you seen it?
No.
Okay, it's produced by Mike Judge, who produced Beavis and Butthead. But this is totally unlike Beavis and Butthead as you could possibly get. It's actually rather realistic. It's a pretty well-written show. And it's all about this guy. This at first he appears to be some unhinged, transient, homeless guy. But he contacts a friend he had in high school and tells her that he's discovered this mysterious kind of glowing blue mushroom growing in this valley in South America somewhere. And this mushroom has advanced healing properties. It can even bring you back from the dead. And he claims he's being followed by these government types. And at first she thinks he's crazy, but then as she looks into it further, it's obvious that he actually is being followed. And whenever it shows a character take this glowing blue mushroom, you see them go into this kind of astral plane. And they often meet these little gnomes or self-replicating machine elves or whatever you want to call them. They look kind of like gray aliens, but not quite. There's one point where one of the DEA agent who has been assigned to follow this guy, you see him reading a book that's called, it's not Food of the Gods, but it has a similar title. So it's clearly supposed to be like a Terrence McKenna book. And when I was watching the first episode with my daughter, who is 17, she turned to me and she goes, this character, the main character, she goes, this guy is like Damien. And I go, you're right. He is like Damien. At first, he seems to be like this crazy homeless guy, but then it turns out he really is being followed. And then he contacts his friend in high school and tells his friend everything that, you know, is happening to him. And then the friend gets pulled into the chaos. So it's clear that whoever was writing the series was very well aware of these kinds of things. And in fact, at one point, he is assigned... you see that they want to follow him, but they kind of farm out the surveillance to what is clearly a kind of like private security firm. It's not like the actual military is following him. It's these kind of like hired thugs who are following him around. So, which is, you know, parallel to the whole gang stalking phenomenon that I write about, the unconstitutional surveillance and harassment program I write about in Camellia.
So and I really recommend that people go back and watch this first episode that we did, I think back like a couple of years ago, about Camellia, where we really talk about this book and a couple of other things in length. And yeah, it's absolutely mind-blowing story.
And it's just interesting how there are certain people in Hollywood who are obviously aware of these things and they put them into the films. Now, someone like Michael A. Hoffman, who wrote Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare, would say, well, this is a form of like programming. They're kind of rubbing it in your face. But it seems to me that very often it's the writers are either aware of this stuff or maybe they know people that this stuff has happened to, and they're actually trying to put it in a way that's not meant to be, it's meant to be helpful, you know, they're covertly putting these things, these kind of taboo topics in, because if you put it in a fictional form, you're able to discuss these kind of taboo topics in an acceptable way. So it's
a lot of people do that, right? Although it's a bit problematic too, because then at the end, I mean, yeah, you never know what is meant to be truly true information and what is the fictional part. So
well, that's true, because then you have like the X-Files effect, where you try to tell someone something that actually happened, they say, "Oh, you saw that on the X-Files."
Yeah.
So it could also be used to obscure, but this kind of tension between those two poles is something I wrote about in my very first book, Cryptoscatology. There's a chapter in there called "You Name the Dwarves," which is the very first article I ever published anywhere in an issue of Paranoia magazine back in 1996. And the topic of that article, I talk about guerrilla surrealism and corporate surrealism. And when Andre Breton founded the surrealist movement, the purpose was to kind of wake people up, you know, shock people out of their sleepwalking state. But then later on, Madison Avenue discovers these surrealist techniques and starts using them in their advertisements and their commercials. this dismayed Andre Breton that those techniques could be hijacked and used in a commercial sense. So in the article, I talk about these. You have guerrilla surrealism, guerrilla as in guerrilla, guerrilla as in not the animal gorilla, but guerrilla surrealism, and then corporate surrealism. So you have one that is kind of like the actual avant-garde surrealism that's trying to wake people up, and then you have the corporate surrealism that's just hijacking those techniques to sell you stuff, or to obscure stuff, or to put you deeper into a sleepwalking state. So I think that analyzing those two extremes in the form of the difference between art and advertisement happens in these other fields as well, you know, including Hollywood. You have those things, that those narratives that are meant to that are reactionary and are meant to instill fear in you and keep you hypnotized. And then there are those narratives, films, TV shows, books, comic books, that are meant to do the opposite, that are meant to kind of shock you out of your somnambulism.
Yeah. By the way, if anyone wants to ask some questions that I constantly overlook in the chat, the Zoom is open, so you can call in and you can, of course, also just join into the Zoom session. So please do that. Robert, you're still there, right?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Because you just went silent. So, I mean, you already mentioned that before. So there is, if you just take Kay Bender's account and Villas-Boas' account, there are a lot of details. And these are details that are, as you say, often left out, that match up, and that those two individuals, it's highly unlikely that they knew of each other's experiences. So they just talked about those things independently. And Alta Terrestrials also asks, did the symbols seen by Villas-Boas inside the UFO have a Masonic background? And what about the motionless clock, the one whose hands refused to move? So I think he did see also Masonic symbols inside of the craft, like the cubes, the lamps and stuff like that. So maybe you can elaborate a little bit more about those, all those things that reminded you of Masonic rituals or, you know, objects.
It's interesting. We were talking about when we first started this whole conversation, we were talking about how a lot of the stories in Cryptopolis like emerged from dreams. And that's actually applies to this article as well, because this article grew out of a dream that involved Masonic symbolism as well. So it might be interesting if I actually I'm going to read to you the exact dream that I wrote word for word in my dream journal. And I had to dig through an archaeological strata to get to this dream journal in my garage. When I was writing this article, I got to the point where I was like, oh, you know, I should include the actual dream that I had. So I had to go into the garage with an archaeological team to find this notebook. But finally, I did indeed find the exact notebook. So this dream would have occurred in, let's see, February 17th, 1998. And this is the dream. Now, keep in mind, this is before I had any involvement in Freemasonry. And in fact, I had absolutely no intention of becoming a Freemason when I had this dream. And this is the dream. I walk into the Masonic Lodge on Cabrillo Avenue in Torrance, a building I've never before entered. I find myself sitting in a waiting room that contains a lot of empty wooden chairs. I look up at the walls. I see a very realistic painting depicting the face of a white owl. I glance back at the empty chairs, then turn to look once more at the painting. Now the white owl has changed. Its face has merged seamlessly with the attributes of an owl and that of an alien gray as seen on the cover of Whitley Strieber's 1987 book Communion. Now, just a brief side note. Of course, Mike Clellan has published a book called The Messengers, Owl Synchronicity and the UFO Abductee. And Clellan reports many abductees often seeing their abductors in the form of owls. But in 1998, when I had this dream, I had no knowledge that anyone believed there was a connection between owls and aliens. So anyway, back to the dream. In the dream, I am not surprised by this shift. I simply continue staring at the empty chairs. After a while, I glance back at the painting. Now the owl is gone, and the impassive face of a gray alien has taken its place. At this point, I rise from that uncomfortable little chair in the waiting room, stroll into the hall, and approach a pair of ornate wooden doors above which are carved the words Masonic Research Center. I push the doors open and see a vast library of old, rare books on the other side. I very much want to begin reading them all. One particular volume stands out at the bottom of the shelf. I pull out the hefty tome and lift it. In the dim light, the title on the cover is unusually clear and is rendered in Gothic golden lettering: The Freemasons and the Guffey Clan Through the Ages. I don't get a chance to read the book or even open it. Suddenly, I notice that strange, surreal creatures are wandering around in the musty, dust-speckled aisles. They weave in and out of the crowds of normal-looking humans, all of them elderly men who are standing on the stacks looking at old books as well. The creatures appear to have emerged from a surrealist painting by the likes of a Max Ernst or a Remedios Varo, some mad visionary with a bent imagination. The creatures become aware of my presence and begin to hone in on me. So I put the book back on the shelf and run. I find a staircase and traverse the steps two at a time. I pass the second floor, then the third floor, even though the Masonic Lodge in Torrance only has two floors. I press my palms against a metal door and emerge onto the roof. It's nighttime. To my surprise, there's a helipad on the roof. A helicopter, its blades spinning faster and faster, is waiting for me. For a moment, I think I've escaped the angry creatures in the library. I start moving towards the helicopter, then pause abruptly. An eyeless stone dog stands between me and the helicopter. It's motionless. I know it doesn't want me to pass. Its gray, craggy stone flesh morphs into real skin. The dog, a greyhound, turns bright red. Then it moves towards me, its crimson eyes growing larger and larger. I turn away from the hound and begin to clamber over the side of the roof. Fortunately, in the complete darkness, my palms discover thick hemp ropes down which I climb to the sidewalk below. I'm confident I've escaped, and then I wake up. So I thought it was interesting that that dream merges Freemasonry and alien imagery, and then you get the owls too, which is interesting because, as I said, I wasn't aware of Mike Clellan's book, The Messengers, but my mother was totally into owls, and I grew up surrounded by owl figurines, salt shakers shaped like owls, lamps with owls on them. And my mother told me the reason she was obsessed with owls was because when she was a little girl growing up in Rockford, Illinois, she was frightened by this white owl that would sit perched on the tree outside her childhood bedroom window. And she said in her mind, it was like this huge white owl, and it frightened her. And later on, as she grew older, she started collecting owls until she had amassed this like gigantic owl collection. And so later on, when I was 18 and Twin Peaks appeared, there's of course this recurring phrase of the owls are not what they seem. Though that sentence is not explicitly tied in with aliens in Twin Peaks, you do get both kind of extraterrestrial imagery over the course of those two seasons. And you also have this recurring idea of owls not being what they seem to be. And then later on, Mike Cleland publishes this book. But in between that, I have this peculiar dream that combines Freemasonry, alien imagery, and the owls all into one dream. So anyway, I find all that fascinating. So the article kind of partially grew out of a dream that I had.
Yeah, owls are very fascinating, I have to say. And this connection between owls and I think mostly like classical gray aliens and those beings that shape-shift, so to say, between owl shape and alien shape or whatever. Mohnbrötchen in the chat writes, is there a meaning to a friendly owl in a dream? 3 months ago, I had a strange dream with an owl. The owl, she writes later, was as big as 1.5 meters. That would be fitting, wouldn't it?
it's interesting. I've always wondered if the Lorian Fenton was interviewing me one time, and she asked me, she goes, "Do you think you're an alien abductee?" And I go, I don't think so, but I guess you might not know, I guess, right? It's interesting that because a lot of alien abductees describe the same exact experience that my mom had. Now I'm not yes. saying my mom was an alien abductee, but
it does run in families, doesn't it? Yeah,
it does indeed, doesn't it? Yes, I actually once had a very vivid dream where in fact it was in the very room that I'm sitting in right now, and I woke up in the middle of the night and there were three gray aliens standing in the doorway of my bedroom, and they looked at me, and I could see, it's very vivid. I could see like the way what their skin looked like. It was almost like I could reach out and like touch it. It had a kind of interesting like texture to it. And then, and I was like, oh fuck, here we go. And then I woke up in the morning. So, was that a dream? I have no
that
idea.
Is interesting,
I'm not claiming
isn't it?
to be an abductee, but it was a very vivid, interesting dream. And when I was a child, I had a dream about being up on a roof, and there was this gigantic UFO hovering over my apartment building, and it was like fucking huge. It was like the size of a city or something. Now, was that influenced by having seen Close Encounters of the Third Kind or something? I don't know, but it's one of those dreams that I do remember. But there are other vivid dreams that I've had that have no alien abduction or no alien imagery in it at all. One of the earliest dreams I can remember, but what's interesting about this is that I don't remember it as a dream. I remember it as an actual memory. And that is, I was walking down the hallway when I was a kid, and this green hand came out of the wall and grabbed me about the throat and like tried to pull me into the wall. And I can to this day see the hand and what it looked like and what it felt like. And it's kind of had these weird, like yellowish, nails. And, for some reason I think of it as a male hand. I don't know why that is. Later on, I recently wrote a story that I published in an anthology called Extremely Bizarre, called The Pathology of Hands. That was all about, disembodied hands. So maybe that's where that story comes from. But in my mind, this is actually like a memory. Like I remember it like as if I, like a memory of walking down to 7-Eleven and getting a carton of milk. Like that's how I remember the green hand coming out of the wall. but I assume
do you have lucid dreams? That's what ultraterrestrials just asked. Did you ever have a lucid dream? So a dream where you were aware of the fact that you are dreaming?
You know, it's interesting. Yeah. I've never had lucid dreams, but my wife has, and she's had them spontaneously. In other words, she wasn't trying to. When she was a girl, she had this recurring nightmare of being in the ocean, and there was a great white shark like coming at her. And then she said that after having this dream many times, finally she decided in the dream, she realized it was a dream. And she allowed the shark to come at her, and when it got to her, it started chomping on her arm, and the shark's mouth was just rubbery, and it had no teeth, and it was chomping on her arm, but it wasn't having any effect at all because it just felt like this silly rubbery thing. And then she didn't have the dream again after that.
That's interesting. So,
I think that's very interesting. I once saw a lecture by Ray Bradbury at Torrance High, and somebody asked him, do you ever get any of your stories from dreams? And he said, dreams are just, that's just kind of like garbage that your brain is dumping out at night. It has no effect on me whatsoever. and then on the other hand, you have William Burroughs, who had a very active dream life, kept a dream journal. And in fact, one of his last books was called My Education, which was a whole book of just nothing but his dreams. So the two very, you know, to polar opposite opinions there. But I've always had a very active dream life, and I've tried to write down my dreams. And I've had very interesting experiences with, Have you ever read a book called Strange Creatures from Time and Space by John Keel?
No.
In 1994, it was republished as The Complete Guide to Mysterious Beings. But there's a chapter in there called Bedroom Invaders, in which Keel talks about these beings who look like bearded men with red and black plaid shirts who will appear in your bedroom at night and like stand at the foot of your bed. And they've since been called, they call them Flannel Man. Flannel Man will appear in your bedroom at night. And I first read that passage in the Keel book probably around 1994. So flash forward to about 2006, and I'm in bed with my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife. And I wake up, and there's a figure standing at the end of my bed. And it is not wearing a red and black plaid shirt. That's an important detail. It's entirely black in shadow. It's clearly a man. And I tried to get up and to tackle him, but I couldn't because I was paralyzed. And I started to shout. And then my girlfriend, she wakes me up because I'm dreaming and having some sort of like sleep paralysis. And I wake up and she said, "What were you dreaming about? You know, you were like shouting." And I go, "Well, there was a man at the end of the bed and I was trying to tackle him and I couldn't move." And my girlfriend, who's half asleep, she mumbles under her breath, "Was he wearing a red and black plaid shirt?" And then she went back to sleep. And I go, and I woke her up and I was like, "What did you just say?" And she goes, "What?" I go, "You asked me if the figure was wearing a red and black plaid shirt. Like, why did you ask me that?" And she goes, "I don't know." And I go, "Did I ever tell you about this John Keel book?" And I went over to I crossed the room and I pulled out the book and I showed her the chapter, and she goes, "No." And I knew that I had never mentioned it to her. It had not come up. And to this day, she doesn't know why she asked me that question. And I've since learned that there are other people who've actually seen the red and black plaid shirt man, the flannel man, standing at the end of their bed. And since Keel wrote the book, people continue to see this apparition. And I just thought it was interesting that I actually didn't see the red and black plaid shirt, but my wife ask me about it, even though she knew nothing about it. And she was half asleep at the time, which it's almost like weirder than if I'd actually seen the red and black plaid shirt dude at the end of my bed. The fact that she asked me about it, but didn't know anything about it. So I've had all kinds of weird, what's interesting is shared dreams.
Yes.
In 2005, I think around that time, an ex-girlfriend called me on the phone and told me that she had this dream the night before. And in the dream, she and I had been having sex, even though we hadn't been dating for many years. And right after she wakes up from this erotic dream, her boyfriend wakes up in a cold sweat and he's crying. And my ex-girlfriend says, what's wrong? Why are you crying? And he goes, I just had this like extremely vivid, realistic dream that you were having sex with Robert. And my ex-girlfriend goes, like, what do you say at that point?
Yeah.
That's weird.
I kind of did
that same dream.
I kind of did.
it's so she goes, she just pats him on the shoulder and goes, oh, that's there. You know, that's ridiculous. But what I find fascinating about that story is that clearly they were having a shared dream, but who was the originator of the dream? Like, was it her? Was it him? Was it simultaneous? Is it possible that people who sleep together night after night like begin to sync up in the dreamscape? You know, I mean, in a way, that's similar to the DMT spirit molecule.
Yeah,
you know, story.
What
about
we talked
having,
about in the beginning, where people have same, shared experiences in different rooms and.
Yeah, absolutely. My friend. Now this is interesting. I wrote about this in Cryptoscatology. It's in the last chapter. It's called Collaborating with the Dead. A friend of mine had a friend in high school. And it sounds like I'm making up this name, but the guy's name was Steve Seaman, S-E-M-O-N. Mm-hmm. And that was his actual name. And he was like popular guy, valedictorian. He went on to be an FBI white collar crime investigator. And he was the head of the DNC fundraising scandal investigation in 1997. So on November 30th, 1997, Steve Seaman, who's now an FBI agent, he shot himself in front of the police in El Segundo. And it happens on the beach in El Segundo, right next to the Edison power plant that's there. If you ever see the Stephen King film 1408, you'll see John Cusack right near the exact spot where Steve Seaman killed himself. But the whole case begins the night before, because Steve Seaman's in Hermosa Beach. He eats at the same sushi restaurant that Nicole Brown Simpson ate at the night she was killed. And he's there with two friends, quote unquote, that he met while he was an exchange student in Japan. And their names were Koji Kaneshiro and Jumpai Tamanaga. And I mentioned this in the book. They, all three of them, they leave the bar. At 2:30 a.m., Steve starts acting nuts. And he pulls his gun on these two Japanese guys and begins rifling through the car. He doesn't steal the car. He waits for the police to come and arrest him. And according to the newspaper article, he was behaving like crazy and incoherent. 12 hours later, he's released on $145,000 bail. And he goes home and he jots down a handwritten will, or so they say. And then he heads towards the beach. And his roommate is alarmed by this written note and he calls the police. So somehow the police, they track him down to the beach there on the border of El Segundo and Hermosa Beach. And Steve Seaman blows his brains out in front of the cops. So my friend who grew up with Steve is completely shocked by this. This is written up in like the Daily Breeze, the Los Angeles Times, all these local newspapers. Flash forward, in about mid-1999, I meet this guy named Robert Dobbs. who was an archivist for Marshall McLuhan. And I wrote this article about him for Paranoia Magazine called Synchronistic Linguistics in the Matrix. So I was talking to Dobbs a lot at this point. So on the morning of June 28th, 1999, my friend, who grew up with Steve Seaman, he has this intense dream. And Steve comes to him in the dream and says, quote, "They're putting hell on hold and they're using microwave weaponry to reanimate the dead," unquote. It sounds
like a QAnon conspiracy theory.
It does. Yes, it does. So my friend tells me this dream. So that night I'm talking to Robert Dobbs on the phone and I mentioned the dream and the whole story about Steve Seaman and how he died. And so Dobbs he's intrigued by this and he goes, "You know, I know this medium who's in contact with 7,000 dead entities, and I've had great success getting like verifiable information from them. So I think, what the hell? Why not?" So I give Dobbs all the information I have on Steve Seaman. So meanwhile, I decide to file a Freedom of Information Act request through the FBI about Steve Seaman, because you can get FBI files on anyone who's dead if you can verify the fact that they're dead. So, and who better to ask than his employer, the FBI? So I file a FOIA on Steve Seaman, and I decide to do an experiment. So I write two different letters, one from my friend and then one from me. The one from my friend is dated July 7th, 1999. Mine is dated August 1st, 1999. His is a completely normal letter. It very businesslike. It's exactly what you'd want to write to get a good response from the FOIA people at the FBI. My letter, the one I wrote, is completely insane. Let me see if I can find it here. I'm flipping through the book, chapter 22.
So you mean you could have included it in Cryptopolis?
No, it's in Cryptoscatology, very first book.
Okay.
This is the letter I sent under my own name. "Dear Madam Sir, on the night of 6/27/99, a man who identified himself as Steve Seaman appeared to me in a dream and told me that the government was using microwave weaponry, i.e. cellular phone towers, to reanimate the dead. Hell is being put on hold," were his exact words. "He then asked me to initiate a FOIA search for any records pertaining to his life, death, and career. Imagine my shock when I checked the records of my local newspaper and discovered more than one article about the mysterious suicide of an FBI agent named Steve Seaman, who grew up in Torrance, California. Under the provisions of the Freedom of Information Act, I request access to all records pertaining to the Bureau's investigations into the life, death, and career of Steve Seaman from 1969 to 1997. Mr. Seaman was born January 7th, 1969, and died on November 30th, St. Andrew's Eve, 1997. Seaman was on the FBI squad investigating the Democratic National fundraising scandal when he ostensibly decided to take his own life on a beach in El Segundo. First and foremost, I'd like to see any documents pertaining to the investigation of Mr. Seaman's death. I'd also like to see any documents pertaining to Mr. Seaman's connection to the DNC investigation, microwave weaponry, cellular phone towers, and or the reanimation of the dead. I'm willing to pay for copying expenses that do not exceed $35. If any part of this request is refused, please explain the specific exemption justifying the refusal and direct me to the legal appeals procedure. I've included three articles from the Daily Breeze reporting Steve Seaman's death in order to prove that the subject of this FOIA request is indeed deceased, at least to some degree. Thank you very much for your attention. I look forward to hearing from you. Sincerely, Robert Guffey." So early in October of 1999, Dobbs flies to British Columbia to meet with this medium. So Dobbs speaks to, ostensibly, according to him, he speaks to Steve's spirit for 15 minutes, and the conversation is recorded, which I have a recording of. So this is what Steve says. Ostensibly, from the other side, Steve says that his mental imbalance that night was due to being given a drug that was so sophisticated it wasn't detected during the autopsy, and the drug was slipped into his drink by these two Japanese guys while they were at California Beach Sushi in Hermosa Beach. By the way, it was rumored for many years that restaurant was owned by the Yakuza, but that's a whole other thing. So Kaneshiro and Tamanaga, those are the two guys, according to Steve Seaman, were working for this Japanese intelligence agency, and they wanted to pump Steve for information about his investigation in the DNC scandal. And the mission was to dig up dirt on specific politicians involved in the DNC scandal that Steve was looking into as the head investigator. So the intent was to blackmail the weak sisters involved in the scandal. And the purpose of the drug was to unbalance and make Steve Seaman talk about this investigation. It was like a truth serum, in effect. So, but instead, it caused him to go nuts. And when he was released from jail the next day, his whole world had basically caved in, because you can't continue to be the lead investigator of the DNC scandal if you've been arrested for like carjacking to two guys in Hermosa Beach, right? So he had violated security oaths, and he'd given these two guys sensitive information. So his brain is still disordered, and he thought suicide was like the only way out.
Oh my God.
So this is according to the Medium, right? Okay. So he's given this drug that makes him do this. And according to Steve's statement, the FBI continued to surveil these two Japanese guys. And I don't know what happened after that. So when so on February 2nd, 2000, I receive 232 of 254 pages on Steve Seaman. And there were all these redactions. 22 pages were withheld due to reasons of national security. That's what it said. But what's weird is the files actually confirm some of the details that the Medium had uncovered. So, for example, one document was called Contact with Foreign Diplomats, in which Steve, in his own words, in the documents, confirms that he was working for the Reagan administration in 1989 when he was an exchange student in Tokyo when he was 19 years old. And my friend who knew him knew nothing about any of this. But it's confirmed in the FOIA files. So then about a month later, in March of 2000, my friend, who, remember, he's the one who sent the normal official sounding letter, he received a letter from the FBI saying that they had no information they could share with him about Steve Seaman. So what is the point of this? In response to the letter that talked about reanimating the dead with microwave weapons, they released 232 pages. To the normal one, the one that played by the rules, they released 0 pages. So
that's very strange. I mean,
so I thought that was an interesting experiment. So they released the legitimate actual FOIA files to the guy who was completely nuts, and then to the guy who wrote the completely sane letter, they released no information.
Maybe they thought it's safe to release to the nuts guy, because the guy who's nuts, because he won't do anything with it, but the other one might be sincerely investigating this. I don't know. Doesn't make any sense.
That was my interpretation.
Okay. Well.
And then in the book, a footnote 6, it says, anyone who receives a visit from Steve Seaman in their dreams can feel free to contact me via my email address, which cryptoscatology@gmail.com, which I put in there. And then oddly enough, I actually got an email from a guy who was friends with Steve Seaman in high school, who said that he also was visited by Steve in his dreams.
Oh my God. So just a pile of absolute strange things and absurdities. Bender and Vilas Boas, yeah, both repeat Masonic rituals. And both, as far as I remember, you talked about Vilas Boas' involvement with strange green-dressed men, some allegedly from NASA that his sister talked about. I mean, NASA guys. Okay. Maybe we get to talk about Jack Parson as well, but we're getting to the end. But
we have you. We haven't mentioned the Jack Kirby article.
We haven't mentioned it. I'm not sure if we will get to that one, to be honest. I think we have to leave that for another one. So they both talk about, as you said, about Masonic rituals. They're both then visited by, you know, government officials. Villas Boas even gets a lot of property in California near San Francisco, so that's worth a lot.
That's an intriguing detail. I mean, if in fact his sister is telling the truth, they were showing a great deal of interest in him.
And the question is why? Yeah, and the question is why, really? Because it's a complete absurd story, you know. Why should anyone, you know, why should the higher ups, if we assume that that's the case, pay any attention to that? And in your article, you speculate that maybe some of those higher ups, in quotes, recognize those Masonic symbols, and that's why they.
I think so. I think that's what happened. And in fact, there's possibly a whole book in this topic. It would be interesting to analyze other alien abductee contactee cases through this lens.
Did you do that? Did you look at any other? I mean, I was thinking about whether I could come up with any of those, but I don't know. Nothing really popped into my mind. But did you find any other examples?
I didn't go beyond Antonio Villas-Boas, but it would be interesting to do that. I mean, there is potentially a whole book in that topic of analyzing Masonic hermetic symbolism in other contactee cases. I think that might be really fascinating.
Yeah, and I think there is. I mean, but okay, I can't name an example right now. But so again, someone recognizes that this is a Masonic ritual that is being carried out there. And that's why they're interested in those cases. Now, the question one really has to ask here is why those similarities? Either we can put them down as pure coincidences and nothing to see here, just, you know, it's just some crazy people making up some stories. And then, but if we assume, okay, these are real stories and these are real parallels between at least those two cases, and one could assume that there are other parallels, and that then these are being recognized and the people approach them. So the question becomes, are those Masonic rituals being imitated by whoever is abducting Villas Boas or whoever Kay Bender is in contact with? Or is it the other way around? Because you also mentioned a guy, let me find that in my notes, who basically is saying that these rituals are older than the planet and they've been spread throughout the solar system, you know. So the question becomes, are maybe we or Masonic brotherhoods and other secret societies, are we actually mimicking them, whoever they are? Long question, sorry, but yeah.
That's the central question, isn't it? Like, yes. which is the simulation, and which is the originator? There's an obscure book that's quite interesting called "The Dark Gods" by Anthony Roberts.
Yeah, that's what I was searching for. Yeah, yeah.
And it's a little known book. It came out in 1980. The introductions by Colin Wilson. I had to find a British paperback of it. And there's a passage in the book that reads, "A bold acknowledgement of the supernatural ultra-terrestrial element at the roots of Masonry was made by a certain Dr. George Oliver." It's interesting. My wife's maiden name is Oliver. So there's another synchronistic linguistic thing there. A certain Dr. George Oliver, writing in 1823, Dr. Oliver was a historian of the Masonic tradition, and he openly recognized that the inner secrets of Masonry were not only confined to this planet, He wrote, quote, "The ancient Masonic tradition, and I have good reasons for believing this, says that our secret science existed before the creation of this globe and that it was widespread throughout other solar systems," unquote. The good reasons that Dr. Oliver professed stem from the archives of the Masonic order to which he belonged. I've been desperately trying to track down this article. You know, I want to read the original article by Dr. George Oliver that is referenced in The Dark Gods, but they're a little obscure about where they're quoting from. So I actually went, I was doing searches on the internet, and I found there is indeed a Dr. George Oliver. He did write for Masonic publications back in the 1800s. I found other articles by him, but I can't find this article. So I really want to find this, whatever it is that they're quoting from. I mean, it sounds plausible since Dr. George Oliver was a Mason. He did exist. He wrote about Masonic symbolism in other situations. So it's plausible, but I haven't found the actual source material for this quote, but I'm still looking for it. And there's not a lot of sort of extraterrestrial imagery that is explicit in Freemasonry. There's more of that in Rosicrucianism, because the Rosicrucians actually have very specific rituals and teachings that involve other planets. So there's an overlap between Rosicrucianism and Freemasonry, of course, and my late friend Richard Schoengert, the scientist I wrote about in Camellio, he in fact was both a Rosicrucian and a Freemason, and I did an extensive interview with him in an issue of Nexus magazine back in 2016, where he talked about how being a Rosicrucian and a Freemason, actually, he recommended belonging to both because there are certain gaps in one filled by the other, and that his knowledge of Rosicrucianism helped him interpret some of the symbolism in Freemasonry, and that, and also Richard was a scientist. He was an engineer. He was an inventor, and he was the first person to be granted a patent in optical camouflage technology, i.e. invisibility technology. And he said that, his science background enabled him to understand some of the symbolism that was embedded in Masonic ritual that might have gone over the heads of other people, and he elaborates more on that in this interview that I did with him. And so it was interesting talking to him about all this, because he was coming at it from a perspective of not just being interested in esotericism, but also having that scientific background. So, you know, his theory was that a lot of the Masonic rituals were meant to encode certain scientific breakthroughs that maybe would have been looked down upon by, say, the Roman Catholic Church, where you might get burned at the stake for daring to investigate certain scientific ideas that would have been considered sacrilegious at the time. So you had to go underground and create these secret societies in order to look into these things. There's a whole book by Robert Lomas called Freemasonry and the Birth of Modern Science that goes into this idea of the secret school, scientists who had to form secret societies in order to investigate scientific matters. I think I might have mentioned on your show in a previous time that Adam Weishaupt, when he formed the Illuminati, was probably just trying to get around the strictures and the red tape and bureaucracy of academia. Sometimes you have to form a secret society in order to cut through the red tape and get anything done. A lot of people who are dead set against secret societies don't really think of the fact that, you know, that they themselves are probably part of secret societies, but they don't recognize that. You know, they just think of it as their friend group. Well, I'm part of my friend group. And but meanwhile, someone else on the outside is like, they won't let me into their club. And so one person's secret society is someone else's just, oh, that's just my friend group, you know. There's a great moment in the documentary that was made about John Ronson, who wrote The Men Who Stare at Goats.
Oh, my God. You know, what a great book.
He did that whole documentary series for the BBC called, I think it was called The Secret Rulers of Earth or The Secret Masters of Earth, something like that. And, you know, John Ronson was the one who asked Alec Jones to go and infiltrate Bohemian Grove.
It's the book called Them. I mean, absolute
right.
Recommendation.
Absolutely. And there's one episode, each episode of the series, The Secret Masters of Earth, or it's something like that, is devoted to a different topic. So there's one episode that's about Bohemian Grove, and there's like one episode's about it's like the Trilateral Commission, and he's interviewing this one guy who's actually a member, and the guy says something like, he goes, well, we're not a secret society, and then, you know, we're not like secretly controlling the earth or something. And then he proceeds to elaborate on that thought, and it sounds like what he's saying is that they're secretly controlling the earth. and John Ronson says, is it possible that this guy is a part of a conspiracy and doesn't know it?
Yeah.
You do get that sense sometimes, like, yeah, well, no, we're not secretly controlling anything. This is my friend group, you know. Yeah. We're just
working in the background to improve things and not to, you know, stir up too much dust.
Sometimes society needs a little nudge.
Yes.
and then someone else is listening to that and going, well, gee, that sounds like a conspiracy, doesn't it? It's interesting that there's a book, in fact, by James Billington, called Fire in the Minds of Men. That's not a conspiracy book, because James Billington was like the head of the Library of Congress, you know, a respected historian. And this book is a thick tome, and it goes into the influence of secret societies on like the French Revolution, the American Revolution. And these are accusations that have often been brought against the Freemasons and other secret societies by like the John Birch Society or like far right wing organizations like that, where they say, oh, you know, the Illuminati, the Freemasons, they were involved in fomenting the American Revolution and bringing democracy to the United States. And I'm sitting here thinking, why is that a bad thing? Like, why? Why is it? Why is it bad that the secret society fomented the American Revolution? Manly P. Hall wrote a whole book called "The Secret Destiny of America" that's about exactly that topic. You know, a lot of these things are they're the influence of secret societies on historical events is absolutely a valid topic to discuss. But other people kind of weaponize those things and then turn it into a kind of a strange form of demonology, and then kind of try to weaponize it as propaganda. But and then other people dismiss it entirely. Oh, you know, there's nothing to that. There's no influence of secret societies on historical events, when there's evidence that there has been significant impact on historical events due to the influence of secret societies. So,
and not all of this influence might always be beneficial, neither. I mean, you know,
right? Yeah, absolutely. But you kind of have to come to it from a, you know, take that kind of balanced historical perspective that James Billington has, and not fall down a rabbit hole of fear and paranoia about it.
Mm. Which is a dogmatic view.
Right. Yes.
There's one thing I have to bring up before we maybe move on. No, I don't think we'll get to Kirby. Anyway, I already mentioned this article on extraterrestrials about BOAS CE four experiences. It's, by the way, linked up in the news. So Bosko Nedeljković, a guy apparently involved in CIA psyops, allegedly told a UFO investigator, the UFO investigator Rich Reynolds, in 1978 that he was Nedeljković, that he was part of a project called Mirage that alleged that allegedly faked UFO incidents as a cover up for other activities, in quotes. And that's the interesting thing, Vilas Boas allegedly was one of the victims of Project Mirage. How would that fit in?
That's very interesting because I wrote my second book is called Spies and Saucers, and it's a collection of three novellas that all take place during the 1950s. And the third, there's three novellas. The first one's called The Fallen Nun, Communist Town USA, and Spies and Saucers. And they all take place at various points in the 1950s, and they all involve either espionage and UFOs. And the title story, Spies and Saucers, is all about this down-on-his-luck screenwriter who has been blacklisted because he went to like one communist meeting because he was trying to get laid. Like, he doesn't even really care about socialism or communism or anything like that. But he ended up on this blacklist, and now he can't get work anymore. But he had a reputation for writing like horror films and science fiction films. So he's approached in the early 50s by this intelligence agency, and they hire him because they had seen some of the science fiction films that he had written, and they think that he's the right guy for this project. And he has no idea why he's doing this. It's completely compartmentalized, but he's writing like this science fiction screenplay, and he doesn't know why he's doing it, but he's down on his luck. He has to sign like this NDA, but he does it because he's desperate and he needs the money. And then as the story progresses, not to give too much away about it, as the story progresses, he realizes he starts seeing elements of the screenplay that he's writing showing up in the news in the form of alien abduction stories and things like that. And then he realizes that he's been writing the scenario for the alien abductions that are occurring that are popping up in the news all of a sudden. And so he's trying to get out of the program getting killed. And so I've often wondered if there is Masonic symbolism in the Antonio Villaboas story, is it because somebody put it there?
Yes. I mean, if you assume that these are not some, I don't know, beings from somewhere else, another dimension, another planet, galaxy, whatever, another time. But that this is actually some kind of weird scenario, some kind of weird, I don't know what the purpose would be. But that would be another explanation of or answer to the question, are we mimicking them or are they mimicking us? Well, the question would be, no one is mimicking anyone. These are just a bunch of Freemasons having fun, or I don't know.
There's another possibility. You know, it's like the case that happened in the 1980s, where the infamous banker who was killed, and he was hanged. Stephen Knight, the journalist, wrote a whole book called The Brotherhood about this, where the implication was that supposedly the Freemasons had killed this guy because. And he was a banker, and it was a big scandal in the 1980s, and it tied into the P2 Lodge scandal in France, or rather in Italy.
Italy, yeah.
But it always seemed to me that if there was Masonic symbolism in the guy's assassination, it seemed more like somebody desperately wanted other people to think that the Freemasons had killed this guy. it was so blatant that it didn't seem as if something that any rational Freemason would do, because it was just so obviously, it's like in when Sirhan Sirhan was caught, red-handed shooting Robert Kennedy, they found him with a newspaper article pinned, literally pinned to his chest, like in his shirt pocket, that had a headline saying like Robert Kennedy supporting Israel. And that was like circled in red, like three times and underlined, like, here's the motive. You know, like whoever hypnotized Suran was like, be sure to put this little newspaper article on him so they find the motive. So I always, you know, if there's somebody, if there is Masonic symbolism embedded in this kind of scenario, and it's like more of like a mind control kind of scenario, it's not necessarily that Masons did it. It's just people familiar with Masonic symbolism did it, you know, and you can find that symbolism in any, in
yeah,
any
obviously.
Book,
yeah.
You know, in any library. So, you know, the possibilities are endless. Walter Board, who I was friends with, wrote Operation Mind Control, which was the very first really major important book about MK Ultra. Mm. And certainly, Walter passed away in 2007.
You spent a night in the desert with
yes.
And we talk about this in another show. So I urge everyone to listen to the previous shows we did. Yeah,
I remember telling that story, and there's a story in Cryptopolis that was inspired by me and Walter going out to Joshua Tree and
yeah.
seeing that UFO.
Yes, I recognize that one. Yeah, yeah.
So that was kind of like a metaphorical kind of dream version of those events. But Walter, you know, I had many conversations with him before he passed away, and certainly he believed that certain alien abductions, not all alien abductions, but Walter thought that certain alien abduction cases may have been covers for MK Ultra mind control experiments that were going on from, you know, the 40s onward all the way to the mid 70s when they supposedly stopped the program. So
sure,
you know, that's a possibility as well.
There was recently an article in the Wall Street Journal. It was titled "The Pentagon Disinformation That Fueled America's UFO Mythology." Maybe you've heard about it. And it basically talks about U.S. military fabricated evidence of alien technology and allowed rumors to fester to cover up real secret weapons programs. So also on Grenzwissenschaft Aktuell, Andreas Müller wrote about it, and he also wrote about a rebuttal that others gave to that. So, of course, it's a big controversy. But coming back to this Project Mirage, do you think that something like this could be going on? I mean, you gave an example that makes it almost obvious that something like that is going on. That, I don't know. I mean, these...
Well, I was thinking about that just this past December when we had the, you know, a rash of drone sightings.
Oh, my God, yes.
And, you know, immediately I flashed back to Damien's experiences in 2003.
Yes, he saw...
He
was
San Diego.
Yeah, he was followed by drones, by saucer-shaped drones for
followed by
saucer-shaped
drones in 2004 before, you know, drones were commercially available, and the whole drone swarm that happened in December, which consumed the headlines and then just kind of like just dropped off the headlines a couple of months later. You know, I mean, recently we saw the effects of Operation Spiderweb. I believe that was the name of it, where Ukraine attacked Russia with this truck full of drones that came out and wiped out like 13 of their fighter jets, you know? So we've seen how sophisticated these drones are now compared to like the lone little drone that was following Damien around 2004. I mean, now they, you know, this drone attack like wiped out a significant portion of these Soviet fighter jets. And it's interesting that the drone swarm happened in December, and then this Operation Spiderweb thing that Ukraine initiated happened just a few months later. I almost wonder if the drone swarm that happened in December was, in fact, to cover up experiments with top secret forms of drone technology. You know, you kind of flood the news cycle with a whole bunch of high strangeness to cover up, you know, with the real the real operation is that you're interested in. It's interesting that I coincidentally was reading Leonard Stringfield's book, Situation Red, which came out, I think, in 1976. Situation Red, the UFO siege, which is about a UFO wave back in 1975. And as I was reading Stringfield's book, as this drone UFO wave happened, so I was reading about a UFO wave from 75 when this happened in the end of 2024. And it suddenly struck me that I just mentioned that, you know, MK Ultra ended supposedly in 1975, and that's when Richard Helms had all the MK Ultra documents, you know, shredded, burned, and supposedly the end of the program. It's interesting that this UFO wave that Stringfield's writing about happens at the same exact time period that they're supposedly ending MK Ultra. Because some of the phenomena that is described in Stringfield's book, there's this one chapter about this invisible ray that melts this family's like silverware and it heats up their skin, but it doesn't permanently damage them. It almost sounds like Havana Syndrome, but like mm-hmm. 1975. And mm-hmm. I almost wonder if, as the MK Ultra thing was ending, it's like a bunch of kids who stole some fireworks and now they need to get rid of them all at the same time. is this partly responsible for this high strangeness wave in 1975? It's like, oh man, we got to get rid of all this stuff. We might as well just use it all right now. Let's just use it all up right before they pull the funding, you know? Because some of the stuff that he reports doesn't necessarily really sound like this one particular chapter about the invisible ray. It's not really connected to any particular UFO sighting. He just throws it in there because there are all these other flying saucer sightings happening at the same time. But it sounds more like, you know, like an EM non-lethal weapon kind of thing. And so I wonder if there was some experimentation going on against the backdrop of these other, you know, genuine UFO sightings. Because what better time to experiment with that stuff when there's actual genuine high strangeness going on, right?
Yeah. Which, I mean, Android also asked a question right at the beginning of the show, and we could fit it in. Really coming to the end, so of course the Skinwalker Ranch is also a place where there, allegedly is real paranormal phenomena. But then, well, our mutual, I would call it acquaintance, Chris Marks, interestingly enough, I got in contact to him through you. Or somehow, I think back then.
The other years way around, ago, you got in contact for me through him.
Yes. Oh, God. It's the other way around. Yeah. But you guys were in contact and then, yeah, right. And Android asks, and I also asked that question. So this episode with his wife and those, obviously, I mean, really outrageous things that he said, and they're caught on tape, so I think he really said them. But it got a lot of attention. Do you think that has anything to do with him being quite vocal about what he thinks happened at Skinwalker Ranch? And anyone who's interested, he can listen to the shows I did with this person, this Chris Marks.
Oh, you mean like almost like a setup kind of situation?
Not necessarily a setup. I mean, he said those things, you know, and I know from later conversation or when I talked to him, I realized, okay, I mean, this guy was in Iraq, you know, he was on the, he was right wing. Yeah. Okay. So, and he said some, in my opinion, quite outrageous things, but okay. But that it got so much publicity, you know, a lot of people talk, you know, quarrel with their wives and maybe say things in anger that they wouldn't necessarily mean. I mean, he sounded to me like a reasonable person, but you never know, he was into counterintelligence, so I don't know. But that it got so much so much attention in the press, that might have to do with the fact that he was vocal on a couple of shows. I mean, Robert Fleischer interviewed him, and then he was on the podcast of his former wife that he then split up with in a quite ugly scene.
Right. Well, I mean, I wouldn't rule it out. However, I question how much publicity it really got. I mean, I know that there was some local attention that it got, like in Utah. I do know that.
Yeah. Okay.
It,
yeah.
It was a real uphill battle for Erica Lukes to get the authorities to really do anything about it for like a long time. They were really dragging their feet. And in fact, it seemed like they were going out of their way, bending over backwards to kind of circle the wagons around him for a long time.
Okay.
They
defending one of their own, maybe. Yeah.
That's true. But also almost, blocking the investigation, you know, and keeping him, you know, in a position where, you know, he was still being paid by the National Guard. And it took a long time for any of this stuff to actually manifest, you know, for the investigation to actually do anything about it, which I think that in other situations, it would have, if he wasn't a member of the National Guard, I think that, you know, if this was a traditional domestic violence situation, I think it would have been handled more quickly. Particularly given the fact of what he, I mean, he was, you know, threatening to shoot people, you know.
No, he was threatening to shoot right wing student protesters. Left wing. Sorry.
Yes.
And only those. I mean, and that's, yeah, okay. Now, we, needless to say, he said some outrageous things. But okay, so what you're saying is, no, not really, quite the opposite. So they were actually trying to protect him, and then he got, yeah. And you're right, it wasn't really reported on. It was just local press that reported, yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't remember like the New York Times reporting on it or something like that.
No. I think it was just a local paper. Okay, yeah, fair enough. So no conspiracy there. Probably on Skinwalker Ranch, but who knows?
Well, I don't know if there's no conspiracy. But there. I think it is interesting that Chris Marks got doxxed in the same incident that where the sheriff of Riverside was also doxxed as a secret member of the Oath Keepers. And the sheriff of Riverside County, he came out and he said, oh, well, first of all, I didn't know I was a member of the Oath Keepers, which I don't know how that happens. And then he said, but, you know, he goes, the Oath Keepers, they're not really an extremist organization. It's like, wait a minute. First he says, I don't know what the Oath Keepers are. I didn't even know.
But he knows what they are not.
Right. It's like, wait a minute. You don't know what they are, but you know that they're not extremist. I don't understand that. So it really, it kind of disturbed me that I was in contact with Chris Marks. He because of him, I met you. And we were exchanging emails. I had a long conversation over the phone with him. He seems sincere to me,
yeah.
You know, when he's telling me about these experiences on Skinwalker Ranch, seemed like an affable fellow. And then suddenly I find out that he's like a member of the Oath Keepers.
What's going on? That was a surprise to me too. Yeah.
But it's almost like you can't even keep track what was the intent of all of that? Why was he initiating this relationship with me, where he's like getting me in contact with you? I mean, was that?
Well, I think that was
interested in.
Yes, I think so. I think he was generally interested in the whole subject, and he encountered episodes, or he lived through episodes on Skinwalker Ranch that really reminded me of, and him obviously, of camouflage technology. So,
well,
invisibility technology. So, yeah.
He claimed that he had seen stuff on the ranch that at first he thought could only be paranormal. And then he read Camellio, and then he said,
exactly,
you know, thinking back on it, it could have been this kind of thing instead.
Yeah, so actually you brought him, you got him the idea that he might have been he might have been the experiment there.
His own, yeah, that he had been victimized,
yeah,
in a way, as part of some sort of experimental use of this technology. Yes.
Oh my God. Well, we're talking for 3 hours now. Time rushed by. It was a fascinating show, and we won't get to Jack Kirby anymore. But maybe just to tease him a little bit, like just a couple of minutes here. I mean, amazing guy. He is the author of the X-Men, of Spider-Man, I think. Then I don't know. Almost all superheroes that are currently featured in movies, they seem to be coming out of his pen. So Jack Kirby, absolutely fascinating guy. Also with a lot of interesting symbology, as you point out in your article, the G-bomb. And one thing that I really stumbled across that really fascinated me was that he apparently wrote an article about the face on Mars and published it in Race for the Moon, issue 2 in 1958. He was writing about face on Mars. Isn't that, did you know that? Did you come across that?
Oh, yes. That's a fascinating episode. I'd like to write more about that particular story. I do want to write more about Jack Kirby, and I would definitely focus on that. The article I wrote for the Jack Kirby Collector is called G-Bomb, Masonic and Hermetic Symbolism in the Incredible Hulk. So it focuses specifically on issue number 1 of the Incredible Hulk, and it appeared in the Jack Kirby Collector number 89, which is the spring 2024 issue. And the face on Mars, yes, I first heard about that from Richard Hoagland. Richard Hoagland was on Art Bell.
Whom you met. Night,
who I met. Yes, I shook his hand. I met him at the airport near LAX, where there was a UFO conference going on. And Richard Hoagland mentioned during the interview that Jack Kirby had done a story in the 1950s called The Face on Mars, which was the first time I'd heard of that. Then later, Titan Books did a series of large, oversized hardcover books called the Simon and Kirby Library. So they were reprinting. Each volume focuses on a different genre. So there's like crime, horror, science fiction. In the science fiction volume, you'll find The Face on Mars. And it was in Race to the Moon. And it's this really prescient science fiction mini epic, because it's only like 8 pages long, but you have enough content where you could easily make it into like a 2-hour film. And it contains ideas that won't really make it into the consciousness of mainstream America for like 40 years. And The Face on Mars is about 4 astronauts, and they discover this sculpted face the size of a mountain located on Mars. And these astronauts crawl through the right eye of this huge sculpture, and they find themselves in this like sunlit countryside. And one of the astronauts, he's separated from the others, and he ends up in the middle of this, what he thinks is this interplanetary war. And he realizes that he's actually in this three-dimensional like virtual reality recording that has been left behind to teach future civilizations about the final fate of the Martians. And in the last panel, we see the astronauts making repairs on their ship while they're floating through the debris of this asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. And it's revealed that that was a planet that existed between Mars and Jupiter, but exploded in this interplanetary war. The whole conclusion of the story, where the astronauts gets this information from the virtual reality program, it's very similar to the end of the Brian De Palma film, Mission to Mars. And I almost, when I read the story, I wondered, did the guy who wrote Mission to Mars like read this Kirby story and just decide it's to very like
very possible, very possible.
And the last line of the story is the final caption says, like, I didn't explain it all to, you know, my fellow astronauts. He and all mankind would learn it all someday from the face on Mars. It prefigures, you know, the Monuments of Mars, the Hoagland book, but it also prefigures Tom Van Flanderen's whole exploded planet hypothesis that he puts forth in his book, Dark Matter. And it prefigures Mission to Mars. So that's just one example. Like, Kirby has all these ideas that are very, very prescient. He did a series called OMAC, which stands for One Man Army Corps, in the 70s, that combines, he has a device in there that he calls a smart bomb. I mean, that's actually what, and it's this kind of like robot, you know, missile. And OMAC combines, you know, conspiracies and mega multinational corporations involved in conspiracies There's one, if you look at the cover of issue 2 of OMAC, you'll see this character that looks exactly like Donald Trump. And he's built this whole city to assassinate OMAC.
As I said, an absolutely fascinating person, Jack Kirby. And you also asked the question whether he was an amanuensis, so basically someone who receives information out of the, you know, big void or whatever you want to call it. And another example would be James Joyce. So that would explain how he gets all of these ideas and all of these concepts and also a lot of other examples that you bring in this article. But I guess we have to save that one for another show. But I guess, sure. I hope we made everyone curious about that.
I do plan on writing more about Jack Kirby's work.
Yeah, that's good. Then I'm very much looking forward to it. And I guess we pretty much came to the end of our tonight's show. Is there anything, any final words you want to say about all this, about this eerie connection between Masonic rituals and abduction experiences?
Nothing except to say that it is a topic that interests me and that I think it's something that's worth expanding on.
I
could see writing future articles about that topic, definitely.
Yeah, and it's a great way to escape reality. Well, not to say that those things are not also part of reality, but Android, he just wrote that Iran apparently has attacked Tel Aviv. And I agree with Android, doesn't look too good. But let's see. It's truly a Friday the 13th, I would say.
Yes, that is a true statement.
Yeah. So, Robert, what a trip. I mean, again, Cryptopolis, amazing book. The article Freemasons from Outer Space, it was published. I mean, it's not somewhere available on the internet, which is sad, but I linked up the magazine that it was published in, so anyone who wants to read it, and it's a fascinating article. I guess
you can still get the print version of the.
So they can order the print version that I totally recommend. Sure. It. The magazine so looks quite good as well. I forgot what it's called. What was it called again?
New Dawn.
The New Dawn magazine. Yeah, see.
New Dawn special issue number 5, I believe.
From another hint, huh? New Dawn.
there
we go again. Okay, Robert. Thank you for this fascinating evening. I'm looking forward to all the other stuff that you will be writing and that I will hopefully be lucky enough to talk with you about on this little
show. My next book, Hollywood Haunts the World, comes out November 6th.
And we definitely have to do a show about that.
Absolutely. And you still have to come out to California so you can go to Giant Rock and the Integratron.
But you understand that at the moment I'm a bit hesitant, especially with my name and what you read. I don't know. I mean,
I completely understand.
But I often think about that, and yeah, careful what you wish for. I'm gonna be haunting you.
Yeah, we may have to smuggle you in.
That's okay. As long as you can smuggle me out again, I'm fine.
Yes, we can do that through the Masonic subterranean tunnels.
Oh, that's great. Or I can just put on a cloaking dress.
Yes. Yeah? So, yes, there's always that possibility.
There's always that possibility. Wonderful. Looking forward to that. Robert, many, many thanks. And shout out to Long Island. Long Beach. No, not Long Island.
Long Beach,
that's the other side of the continent. Yeah. Thank you very much. And yeah, talk to you soon.
Thank you. I look forward to speaking to you again.
Okay. Then bye. Have a good day in California. So it's 1 o'clock now, all right?
It is, yes. It's 1:11.
1:11. Oh, see?
Yes.
Another one. 1:11. So let's.
Yes.
What a great time to end. Okay. Have a good day. And
okay.
Looking forward to your next writing.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye.
Goodbye.
Crop FM.
You are far from home, baby. Baby.
Das nächste Mal ist mein Gast Jascha Schmitz. Und wir sprechen über seinen Werdegang vom Zeugen Jehovas zum meines Erachtens brillanten Vlogger zu Glaubensfragen, im weitesten Sinne christliche Perspektiven auf moderne Phänomene und zeitgenössische Zugänge zu Spiritualität. Über das alles werden wir sprechen. Und wer weiß, über was noch zu hören am 27. Juni 2025. Jascha Schmitz live auf Crop FM, und mir bleibt nur mehr, mich bei allen zu bedanken fürs Zuhören und fürs Interesse, für die tollen Fragen. Heute leider kein Anruf, aber gut, bei englischen Sendungen ist halt immer so eine Sache. Ja, danke fürs Zuhören, und wir hören uns wieder am 27. Juni 2025 mit Jascha Schmitz. Bis dorthin, macht es gut.